You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Michael Kazin. He is a professor of history at Georgetown University and the editor of the fine magazine Dissent, magazine of politics and culture published since 1954. He writes about history. He writes frequently in the New York Times, Foreign Affairs, The Nation, The Daily Beast. And we are going to talk about his new book this year called War Against War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1918. Michael Kazin, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Great to be here. Thanks.
It's a centennial in a way of this war, isn't it?
Very much so. The U.S. declared war on Germany April 6, 1917.
Smart move. Good results in the long term?
I don't think so, no. the war had been going on for almost 3 years by the time the United States entered the war, and U.S. Economically was tilting towards the Allies, Britain and France and Italy. Russia was also an ally at the time, but it was getting out of the war due to revolution. I think even though most Americans by the time the U.S. declared war were probably in favor of it, and the U.S. actually had a major part in deciding how the war turned out, because all these fresh American troops came in to Europe, and the Germans just couldn't handle that many fresh troops. The Germans were exhausted and hungry, and there were strikes taking place in Germany and also in other countries in Europe. But I think the result of the war was that the Germans lost, and the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, who said he wanted a world made safe for democracy, ended up with a lot of bitterness on all sides, help in the rise of Hitler. In Germany, there were revolutions which took place in Russia, of course, and also almost revolutions in other countries, which wouldn't have happened without the bitterness and misery caused by the war. And in the end, World War I, as most people who know their history know, was just a precursor to World War II, because Hitler was a colonel in the German army and really believed that his side had been stabbed in the back, as he put it, by Jews and socialists who tried to maneuver to make sure the Germans lost the war. So, to make a long story short, World War I helped bring on World War II, did not bring about a more democratic world. In fact, much the reverse. You had authoritarian governments both on the left and the right, which in many ways were the inheritors of the bitterness of World War I. And I think in that sense it was a mistake for the U.S. to enter the war. It didn't achieve the purposes that the United States leaders wanted to achieve.
In fact, you suggest in the book that it contributed to the rise of Nazism, of fascism, of Japanese imperialism, the Sykes-Picot carving up of the Middle East that is so popular in that region to this day. And I might even suggest, through the shunning of Ho Chi Minh, the future war on Vietnam. But what would have happened if the United States had not gotten into World War I? Because, the Germans losing, yay, that sounds good to many American ears, I imagine.
Well, this gets into the murky territory of what historians call counterfactual history.
Sure.
Of course, we can never know. Saturday Night Live used to have a great routine. What if Eleanor Roosevelt could fly? Maybe it was a bit sexist, I don't know. But, obviously, you change one very big thing in history, you change a lot of other things. You never know what's going to happen. But it's pretty clear, I think, that, as I mentioned before, all sides, both the side of the U.S. joined, the Allied side, and the side of the so-called Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire on the other side, were exhausted by the war. The people were beginning to get frustrated by it. Many Germans were dying of hunger because there was a British blockade. France had been invaded, northern France, by the Germans, and that's where a lot of the battles on the Western Front took place. So I think there's a good chance, though we'll never know for sure, that if U.S. hadn't entered the war, some kind of negotiated settlement would have been arrived at, Or perhaps the Germans would have won, but winning would have been a rather hollow victory, I think. But either way, it would have been. It's difficult, I think, to imagine the Nazi movement, the National Socialist movement that Hitler ran, arising from a situation where there's a negotiated settlement, no side is really the victor, or where the Germans are victorious. So I wouldn't want to say, oh, well, you know, the Germans should have won to stop the rise of Hitler. But Germany at the time, unlike Nazi Germany, was a semi-democratic country. There was an elected parliament, the Reichstag, in which actually the Socialist Party was the largest single party during World War One. And so it's quite possible you would have had a situation not so different from now, where Germany is would have been a more democratic country, I think, over time, the largest, most economically powerful country in Europe, and perhaps we could have gotten there without a Second World War.
And there were some wise observers at the time of the Treaty of Versailles at the end of World War One who predicted that the brutal manner of ending it, punishing Germany, would create World War Two. But there were even people, as you describe in the book, Americans even before the United States entered the war 100 years ago, that predicted it would be a disaster. Who were these people who had it right at the time?
Yes, these are the people I write about, the people in the Peace Coalition. They're quite a diverse group of people. There were people on the left, socialists and anarchists. Mars Hillquit was an immigrant labor lawyer from Latvia. He was in many ways the leader of the sort of anti-nationalist wing of the Socialist Party, if you will. He wrote a lot of the main statements of the Socialist Party about the war and against the war. Emma Goldman, the famous anarchist, was against the war. But you also had progressives like Robert La Follette, the senator from Wisconsin, who was a Republican. And you had Southern Democrats, who we now think of as quite conservative. Certainly they were Dixiecrats, they were racist, but they also opposed having a strong central government dedicated to military strength and military supremacy around the world. The majority leader of the House of Representatives, a guy named Claude Kitchen from North Carolina, was a leader of the anti-war forces and one of the 50 Congress people who voted against going to war in April 1917. And he was voting against his own president of his own party, Woodrow Wilson. So the argument really of the anti-war people was that there was no national interest of the United States to go to war. If the U.S. Hadn't been carrying military goods for the Allies on American ships, the German torpedoes wouldn't have targeted the American ships. If Americans hadn't been traveling on British and French ships, then they would not be at risk of being killed, they argued. And also they believed, and this is in some ways kind of conservative argument, I believe, that U.S. prepared to go to war, had a massive military as large as the ones in Europe, then it would end up engaging in innumerable conflicts around the world, whether the United States' national interest was at stake or not. And that's an argument that more conservative people who wanted to sort of keep the government smaller and not do very much at home could support, as well as progressives and left-wingers who wanted a stronger federal government in order to help workers and small farmers. So in that sense, it was a coalition based on an agreement about what they didn't like as opposed to an agreement about what they did want.
And it wasn't just a handful of outlier far-seeing radicals, right?
This was not at all. It was there are no public opinion polls yet. That was those didn't really come until the 1930s. But it's pretty clear from the kind of battles you had in Congress, by the fact that in 1916 Woodrow Wilson ran for re-election on the slogan "He kept us out of war," that most Americans did not want to go to war until just a few weeks really before the U.S. actually did declare war. And I think so. The anti-war coalition, that is, people in Congress and outside Congress, I think felt probably rightly, correctly, that they had the people on their side. But there were very powerful forces against them. Teddy Roosevelt, the former president, Henry Cabot Lodge, most powerful Republican in the Senate, And a lot of big industrialists were also in favor of going to war, and the major newspapers in the major cities were as well. So there was a real contest, a real conflict, a real debate about this. But I think it's most historians agree that until just a few weeks before the U.S. went to war, most Americans probably would have said in a public opinion poll, if they'd been asked, that they didn't want to go to war. And one way we know this is one of the tactics that the anti-war coalition tried to use in the last few months before the U.S. went to war was they called on the government to sponsor a referendum, said let Americans vote about whether the U.S. should go to war. This is not in the Constitution, of course, but Congress, you know, is the only body that can declare war in the Constitution. But the anti-war people were pretty convinced they would win such a referendum, or else they wouldn't have called for it.
Yeah. In fact, they kept pushing for it through the 30s, and President Roosevelt was against it, and it never passed to this day.
No, it's called the Ludlow Amendment.
Right. But I think when Roosevelt followed Wilson and got reelected on a "I'll keep you out of war" campaign, nobody thinks he actually meant that. Everybody, as far as I know, thinks he was lying. Was Wilson sincere when he campaigned for re-election on I'm against war, and then not long after was for war?
Well, you know, I think I disagree with, you know, some of the people you you mentioned, I think, on that. I think Wilson was actually quite ambivalent.
I was talking about Roosevelt. I'm asking about Wilson.
Oh, Roosevelt in the late 30s. Yeah, no, that's a different matter. No, I think it's true. I think Franklin Roosevelt understood, and I think he was correct, actually, that the threat of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan was a real threat to American national interests. I think World War II was a war the U.S. needed to fight, as opposed to World War I. But it's certainly true he was not sincere. and of course, even before the U.S. gets into World War II, before the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the draft is reinstituted, the draft which had been ended after World War I, and U.S. Quite openly is helping the Russians and with Lend-Lease and the British try to help defeat Nazi Germany.
Yeah, in fact, this is not the subject of your book, but I can't resist, as we do disagree on this point. Franklin Roosevelt sort of followed Wilson's model and claimed that various German attacks on U.S. ships were attacking innocent ships when they were, in fact, assisting British planes. He claimed to have a German map of plans to carve up South America that was completely fraudulent, claimed to have Nazi plans to rid the world of religion, which was, you know, completely fabricated. And do you think this sort of lying and manipulating of the U.S. public was somehow justified because
knew
better?
I don't think it was justified, but I do think that that the end was justified, as opposed to the end in World War I was justified. That's all I'm saying. And I do think that clearly FDR would have liked to have Germany defeated and have it in Europe and have the Japanese defeated by the Chinese without American troops going in if he could. I don't think he was thirsting to send American troops into battle, but I do think he knew that, as you mentioned, that in the late 1930s most Americans were opposed to going into war in Europe, especially again. And the Congress passed Neutrality Acts, I think, three times in the late 1930s, the language of which was really borrowed from the language of the demands of the anti-war coalition during World War I. So in many ways, what was happening in the late 30s was in many ways a rerun of what happened 20 years before.
It's an interesting contrast to me, though, because in World War I, in your book, which is excellent, I highly recommend, it's called War Against War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1918, Michael Kazin, you suggest that the peace activists really had it right and really saw the future better than anybody else. Where in World War II and the lead-up to World War II, you had peace activists saying, do not get in, allow a negotiated settlement, let the Jews out of Germany, because this was, of course, the Nazi madness originally, was export all the Jews. And the peace activists who went to Churchill and to Anthony Eden and said, bring the Jews out of Germany, you could evacuate all these thousands of British troops, you can do the same. And the response from Churchill and Eden was, we can't be bothered, too much trouble, we don't care about Jews. And the peace activists said, if you keep this war going, they're going to kill more. It seems to me they were right that time as well.
Well, maybe, but the Final Solution, you know, the genocide against the Jews began, as I'm sure you know, before Pearl Harbor, began really right after the during the German invasion of the Soviet Union in June
yes.
and early July 1941. So,
but why keep it going?
Yeah. So yeah, but you know, I think Hitler, as opposed to Kaiser Wilhelm, Hitler really wanted to take over the world. I think he would have once if he'd conquered Britain and of course conquered the Soviet Union, which in the end the Soviet Union really broke the back of the German army or the Wehrmacht, as you probably know, not the U.S. Army.
Obviously,
if he'd done that, then I think he would have tried to take over the United States. I mean, he really believed that. Those with his racial theories, with his genocidal desires, you know, had to dominate the world. And so I think, you know, when you have a figure like that, who's driving the war, in no sense a defensive war, I think, then I think you know, someone like that has to be defeated. I mean, as a Jew, I had, you know, relatives who died in concentration camps in Europe, and I'm very glad that you know, the United States helped to defeat Hitler. As I said before, it was the great irony that a tyrant almost as bad as Hitler, Joseph Stalin, led, you know, his people to really break the back of the German army even before American troops got into to France in 1944.
Yeah, but it seems to me you're correcting a lot of misunderstandings about World War One, and we've got a lot of misunderstandings about World War Two, and we now turn to groups called things like the Anne Frank Center for Wisdom on Opposing Trump's Anti-Semitism. But Anne Frank's visa was denied by the U.S. State Department when her father applied for, you know, ships of Jewish refugees were chased away by the U.S. Coast Guard.
There was no interest in helping
the Jews.
I mean, to underline how, you know, anti-Semitic American foreign policy was, to underline how anti-Semitic, even at times pro-fascist, some people in the British government were, especially in the Conservative Party, the Tory Party, is one thing. That's not to say that World War II, in the end, wasn't a just war. One can look at the terrible things people on the U.S. and British side did and thought before the war, even during the war, with Japanese, you know, relocation, of course, in this country, without taking the next step and saying, "Oh, war must be fought." I think it's possible to think both things at the same time. It's possible to blame the Allied side for all kinds of crimes, the bombing of Dresden, for example, bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki later, of course, without stepping back and saying, "Well, that war could have been avoided." I don't think it could have been because
you
I don't think Hitler was going to stop.
But you think an army that couldn't get Norwegians to obey, that couldn't get the Dutch to obey, that couldn't get the Eastern Europeans to hand over the Jews, that was you know, lessons were being learned in Rosenstrasse and elsewhere that we now know about how to resist occupations. You think they could have conquered and occupied and taken over Russia? And then
I don't know. I mean, obviously, nobody's done it. Obviously, it took 25 million Soviet citizens died, you know, in that war. I think
yeah,
the latest
they,
estimate.
They said 27,
something like that. And so, you know, it seems like, you know, obviously, the Germans and their allies were willing to fight and try to take over the Soviet Union, and so, you know, as a result, you know, so many people died. You know, I just think to take seriously what Hitler was trying to do and what he had the Germans behind him to do for most of the war, at least, even when it started to go bad for the German army. You know, one has to believe. I guess you're a pacifist. It sounds like you're against all wars, and I'm against most wars, but I'm not against wars where I think civilization itself is at stake. I think it was in World War II.
Do you think that Franklin Roosevelt had a committee in Congress stop the Ludlow Amendment and never allow a vote on it because he suspected that with a Ludlow Amendment, the people might vote against war or for some...
Oh, I think that's quite true. Yeah,
yeah, and
theory,
that,
sure.
And
sure.
So the anti...
I mentioned that a little bit in my book, in the last chapter about the legacy of the anti-war movement. No, I think it's quite true, but...
But it doesn't give you any pause. It doesn't give you any pause at all, hesitation, the anti-democratic nature of fighting wars for democracy.
I'd rather have, you know, some anti-democratic acts by Roosevelt, who was after all elected democratically to the presidency, as opposed to the people who were running the governments in Germany and in Italy and Japan who were fighting. I mean, there's no comparison between the anti-democratic acts on occasion of Franklin Roosevelt and the absolute tyranny of Hitler and Mussolini and the Japanese militarists.
Same goes for Trump.
Well, Trump was elected democratically. I hate the fact that he was, but you know, obviously didn't win a majority of the popular vote, but he did win a majority of the electoral vote. And you know, like you, I assume, you know, I hope people keep resisting him every means they have at their disposal. Sure.
Well, every effective, that is, in my view,
exactly,
nonviolent
exactly.
means of.
No, I'm with you there. I think. When peaceful protest is allowed and is flourishing right now, actually, it's absolutely suicidal for a movement to engage in violence.
I think part of the anti-democratic nature of wars, and this goes back to what the topic of your book, World War One, is that there's a need for a draft, and there's need for enforcement of a draft. And beginning with Wilson, we saw this incredible erosion of civil liberties and the locking up of in prison of people who spoke against the draft, and
yes.
you know,
yes.
violent yes. resistance to recruiters. I mean, we think of these wars as bringing freedom and in defense of freedom and so forth, but you know, not only during World War II did we have an apartheid state for African Americans and lock up all the Japanese Americans and so forth, but to get people to fight in the war requires compelling them to.
Yes, definitely. Know. No, I mean, this is what Randolph Bourne famously said, war is the health of the state. And he was quite right about that. And one of the results of World War I is the beginning, I think, of a national surveillance state that, of course, we still have today, which has flourished since 9/11 especially. And it took a break for a while in the 20s and 30s, but then it went full bore, of course, from World War II on. And it never really stopped because the Cold War came on right after World War II as a rationale for a larger intelligence service, more powerful FBI, you know, various other aspects of the national surveillance state. And this, of course, is, you know, many ways World War One began a century of war, at least 75 years of war from 1914 to 1989. And, of course, 9/11 began perhaps, let's hope not, another century of war, at least of constant fear of war and constant readiness for war on the part of the federal government and many Americans as well who were employed in these various parts of the national security state.
Yeah.
So, no, I agree with you there completely, David.
We can agree, I imagine, that you know, you would be happy to have done without World War II by means of doing without World War I and without.
And I would have been happy to do that. I mean, I would have been happy if you know, someone had assassinated Hitler.
but this is my yeah. point, that the World War II and the mythology around it distorts U.S. thinking so much that everybody sort of asks in philosophy class, would you kill baby Hitler? Not would you give baby Hitler a good education and get him into art school and make him a happy human being? No.
I agree.
Would you
kill him? Well, he tried to get into art school. It was his bad art that didn't get him to art school.
It was his nerves. He wouldn't even apply.
I mentioned this in the book too, War Against War, that I think, you know, the United States has been at war through most of its history. People don't really realize that. That includes, of course, the wars against Native Americans. And in fact, you can find very few years in American history where the U.S. was not at war somewhere.
But why do we all say kill baby Hitler and nobody says avoid World War One? You know,
I'm sorry?
The questions in all the philosophy ethics courses in U.S. universities are never, should we have avoided World War I? They're always
right.
The more fantastical, should we have killed baby Hitler?
Yeah. And, you know, I think it is true that, and I mentioned this in the book, that you say yourself that World War II, you know, becomes, well, you know, that war was necessary, which I again think it was by the time we actually got into it. And that becomes a template for other wars. So people keep hoping that the next war will be like World War II.
Right.
And certainly those who take us into war believe that and use some of the same language. They talk about appeasement. They talk about, you know, battling tyranny. You know, so in some ways, we haven't really moved past World War II. And that's a real problem, I think.
I'm trying my hardest.
A problem, especially in Vietnam, which is, you know, I sort of came of age and politically and otherwise during the late 1960s as an anti-war activist against that war. And I think it was very clear that the rationales for defeating the Vietnamese revolution is what it was were very much the same rationales for defeating Hitler.
Yeah, but here we are with Trump proposing another $700 billion or so in our biggest social project of the past 75 years, that is preparation for more wars, and you ask anybody to defend it, and they immediately shout, World War II.
Yep.
And you
right.
say, go
You're
read
right.
this wonderful book about World War I called War Against War by Michael Kazin. And you see, we could have avoided World War II by many, many ways, including having avoided World War I. And they don't want to hear about that. They just want to tell you about the next Hitler, always the next Hitler. And so I think some rethinking about both of these wars and this history of investing in this project for 75 years has to be reconsidered.
No, I think you're right. But of course, once something happens like World War I, then and it does help bring on World War II, then you know, one has to analyze whether it's necessary to fight that war or not. That's my only disagreement with you. I think yes, I wish we had stayed at World War I. Yes, I wish World War I had ended differently. Of course,
yes.
Like you, I wish the war hadn't happened at all. As we know, World War I was completely avoidable.
Yes.
In fact, none of the belligerents in the war even expected to have to fight it when the war began. They all thought, oh, my God, you know, we have to get into the war. The Germans got into the war because they felt the Russians were about to declare a war on them, and then the French got in because the Germans declared war on them. The British got in because the Germans went into Belgium. And it was, you know, this cataclysm that nobody really planned on.
But Wall Street spent the interwar years investing in Nazi Germany. The United States now is, you know, spending these pre-World War III years as the leading seller and dealer of weapons to the world. You know, there is another way possible, and we know so much more about nonviolent resistance and its powers and capabilities now, and so much more about the risk of having these nuclear weapons around. Now that we don't, you know, we don't have another century to play with, you know.
I hope we're not in pre-World War III days. hope you're correct about that.
Well,
I
hope not, but it certainly looks that way if we don't change course. And I recommend this book to anyone who wants to change course. It's called War Against War: The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1918, by Michael Kazin. And I want to tell people that coming up this April 4th, which is the 100 years since the Senate voted for World War I and then was followed by the House and the President a couple days later, it is also 50 years since Martin Luther King Jr. spoke against the Vietnam War at Riverside Church. And we're planning, we at World Beyond War, you can go to worldbeyondwar.org for the details, are planning events around the country and the world. And you, Michael Kazin, and I, and Eugene Puryear, and Medea Benjamin, and Maria Santelli will be speaking at an event in Washington, D.C. This coming April 4th. And I very much appreciate your agreeing to do that and to come on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks a lot. Enjoyed doing it.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnap.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Donald Trump says the press corps are the enemy of the people. The press corps, in turn, say Donald Trump is very presidential. Where the people find themselves in this dance is unclear. We'll talk about what media really looking out for the public interest might look like with author and Fair associate Norman Solomon, National Coordinator of RootsAction.org and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Also on the show, it's been 1 year since the murder of Berta Cáceres. Court documents leaked to The Guardian support the idea that the killing of the Honduran environmental, indigenous rights, and feminist activist was planned by military intelligence specialists linked to Honduras' U.S.-trained special forces. Such extrajudicial killings in Honduras have spiked since the 2009 coup in which the United States played a key role, though that role is beyond obscured in media coverage that presents the U.S. as the solution to violence in that country. We'll talk about that with Beverly Bell of the group Other Worlds Are Possible. All of that's coming up, and we're going to get straight to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group Fair. Sessions met with Russian envoy twice last year, encounters he later did not disclose, was the Washington Post and other media's spin on what others didn't hesitate to call a lie, Attorney General Jeff Sessions' denial, under oath, of the kind of meetings he now acknowledges he had. That bit of damage control came off elite media's startlingly generous, you might say, reception to Donald Trump's speech to Congress, in which the New York Times actually credited him for, quote, following the written text on the teleprompters more closely than any major speech of his presidency, close quote. Trump advocated white nationalism with an indoor voice, and pundits loved it, was how Media Matters put it. Well, this was just as some were thinking that the U.S. press corps had accepted that their relationship with the Trump White House was going to be adversarial, and were maybe even looking like taking a less complacent stand, at least saying that they would call lies, lies. While corporate media try to sort out what they stand for, the question for us is, what do we need from journalism right now? What would truly independent media look like, and how could we use it to move forward? Norman Solomon is National Coordinator of the online activist group RootsAction.org and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's also a longtime Fair associate who joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome back to Counterspin, Norman Solomon.
Hey, thanks, Janine.
Well, I think elite media's treatment of Trump's speech to Congress, the centering of the performance of it rather than its content, the consecration with the term presidential, an utterly reflexive exercise in which media say that media see something a certain way. It was all a clear sign, if that were needed, that while they may do critical work, we can't rely on these media to hold our outrage and concern, to represent it, to represent us, you know. And I think some folks may have started to get a different idea about that for a minute. There's too much to say, of course, but I did want to start with that open question. What are some of the kinds of reporting that a vital democratic media would be doing in the face of a Trump administration?
Apparently, independence is really hard to maintain. And while the the principle, the axiom of a free and independent press is something that journalists really embrace in theory. When it comes down to it, that sort of magnetic pull of power, whether out of the White House or, you know, Capitol Hill, it just seems often irresistible. And so there are so many euphemisms that kick in. And as you mentioned, Janine, the coverage of the Trump speech to the joint session of Congress just oozed praise for the high jump over very low standards of, you know, reading a teleprompter effectively and couching really pretty flagrant xenophobia and racism in more genteel terms.
We've seen just recently, you know, outlets taking umbrage at being excluded from press briefings, and that sort of looks like the Fourth Estate, you know, remembering what it's there for. But at the same time, you know, we've seen journalists arrested for reporting around DAPL, for example, and the elite media didn't come to their defense. And, you know, we see citizen journalists trying to document police abuse. It's a very, you know, cutting edge issue. And we don't see the sort of bastions of traditional media standing up for them. So it's almost like there's this press corps that we're meant to be defending, this First Amendment we're meant to be defending, but it's almost more theoretical than actual.
Well, there's so much of the press, the independent media, that are given short shrift or totally ignored by the dominant corporate media, which, contrary to myth, you know, largely by the numbers, dominate the internet and websites as well. I think that also is parallel to just the political scene. You know, we have this classic dynamic. It's been true for decades. FAIR has pointed it out repeatedly since founding in the mid-1980s, where when the Democratic and Republican Party leadership in Washington have a certain frame of reference, the dominant corporate media stay within it. And I think there's no clearer or more important example than the coverage of Russia and the whole uproar over Trump and Russian contacts and all the rest of it, where the mindset, the worldview of the people in Congress and the White House pretty much are the alpha and omega of where the mass media will go.
No one's saying perjury shouldn't be addressed, but it's so easy to lose sight of what this whole scandal about Russian involvement is grounded in. And it's as though Russia still is, for the media and for many people, a, pun intended, a red flag that kind of shuts down thinking and starts up this machinery of response, which looks very old.
Well, you know, it's new wine in old bottles. And really what is not talked about is so often profoundly in plain sight or should be in plain sight. For instance, it's very rare in all this just tsunami of coverage, this massive coverage, to see any mention of the fact that each country, Russia and the U.S., has several thousand nuclear weapons basically pointed at each other, 4,000 in each country under the military of each nation, mostly deployed or certainly at the ready to basically be able to incinerate not just the two countries, but billions of people on the planet with nuclear winter coming after. You know, neither party, major party, talks about that, rarely talked about in the news media. And then you get to, in all this coverage, with very rare exceptions, the nationalistic double standards, the failure to look at the agendas of outfits like the NSA and CIA to perpetuate and escalate hostility with Russia. We have the assumption that James Clapper, until very recently the director of national intelligence, is some sort of paragon of truthfulness when he was caught flagrantly lying to a Senate committee in early 2003 about surveillance, and we only know that with documented facts because the Snowden NSA revelations came 3 months later. You know, on and on, where basic independent journalism would ferret out and highlight these fundamental contradictions in the claims from people in power versus the realities.
And just in terms of, you know, at a time where we're hearing all these competing interpretations and where there's such a hunger to hear information that feeds a certain perspective, I would think minimally we would look to the media for certain standards of evidence, you know, so that when I see a news media article talking about, well, Trump praised Putin and wink, wink, you know, we know what that means. It just feels like such a throwback in terms of, you know, really separating fact from feeling and you know, evidence from rumor. That's the baseline, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, that is a very McCarthyistic dynamic that the press and many Democrats on Capitol Hill have dragged us into, so that when a statement comes now from the Trump administration or perhaps a commentator on the margins to say that we need a modern equivalent of detente, that the U.S. and Russia have a joint stake in, for instance, not blowing up the planet and better relations and stepping away from the tripwire of nuclear confrontation, where actually, in fact, as the Union of Concerned Scientists points out, we have hair trigger alert nuclear missiles 10 minutes from launch on warning to be in the air. And yet there are aspersions cast, and, you know, even a broken clock can be profoundly correct once in a while. Aspersions cast on President Trump, for instance, at his news conference on February 16th. I mean, yeah, a lot of it was barely coherent, if that. But Trump said some things about relations with Russia that make absolute sense for the survival of the planet. And here are a couple of quick quotes. He said about Russia, "They're a very powerful nuclear country, and so are we. If we have a good relationship with Russia, believe me, that's a good thing, not a bad thing." And yet, to the extent those sorts of words from Trump are cited by U.S. journalists, it's almost invariably to supposedly corroborate that he's some kind of stool pigeon or flunky for the Kremlin. And, you know, by no means is this a right-wing meme particularly. As a matter of fact, it's most prevalent from outlets like MSNBC, from liberal commentators. For instance, the New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, 4 weeks after Trump became president, he wrote, and I'm quoting here from Krugman in his column in the New York Times, quote, "Nothing he has done since the inauguration allays fears that he is in effect a Putin puppet," unquote. And then the column ends with a matter-of-fact reference to the Trump-Putin axis. Well, if that's the attitude of so many commentators, especially liberal pro-Democratic Party commentators, that getting along with Russia and wanting to build bridges towards the Kremlin is some kind of danger to the Republic and perhaps treason, we are in a very dangerous situation.
I think what it underscores for me, Norman, is the importance of separating ideas from people, which is a very difficult thing, I think, for all of us, you know. But I just feel that if you find yourself nodding along to George W. Bush, you ought to know it's time for a paradigm shift, you know. We can say racism is bad, as George W. Bush said, you know, I don't like the racism. And we can also say that we don't really credit George W. Bush as the bringer of that message, you know?
Right.
And so what I'm trying to say is whoever is against Trump is good just doesn't seem like a winning idea. And what I'm looking for from the press, or what I would hope for, is this separation from ideas and their source. And you can support a good idea when a jerk says it, you know, and you can be against a bad idea even when the source is someone that you may have supported. I mean, that's what it's about, isn't it?
Yeah, rather than being knee-jerk and failing to be independent, what we need is really a willingness to report independently in terms of the press and to assess, analyze, and think independently. And it's very hard to do in the polarized environment where it's an either-or sort of binary, which side are you on? I think in a recent editorial, The Nation magazine made the point well when it said, just because Donald Trump is against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it doesn't mean that, therefore, we should say, well, after all, we're for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same would go for better relations with Russia. But so many of us, and it's really hard not to get in this mode, we are conditioned, certainly by the mass media, to choose up sides and to say that anything advocated by someone who we deplore must therefore be suspect or worse. And that's just a prescription for disaster in terms of political thought and for journalism.
We've been speaking with Norman Solomon from RootsAction.org. Thank you so much, Norman, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
March 2nd marks a year since the killing of Honduran indigenous rights and environmental activist Berta Cáceres. The private and state actors believed responsible for her murder never made any secret of the threat they saw from Cáceres and her group COPIN, the Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras. The threat to the ability of extractive industries to steal land and water out from under indigenous people with state sanction. Such predations and the accompanying violence have been exacerbated by the 2009 coup in Honduras, a coup that the U.S., critically, supported. If history is guide, what coverage you may see of the anniversary of Cáceres' death will acknowledge her as a human rights leader, but won't discuss U.S. complicity in her fate and that of many others killed, attacked, or jailed in Honduras for standing up for themselves and their communities. Beverly Bell is coordinator of the group Other Worlds Are Possible and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She worked and traveled with Berta Cáceres and COPIN for many years. Welcome back to Counterspin, Beverly Bell.
Thank you, Janine.
Well, in May of 2015, when we spoke to you last, corporate media in the U.S. were largely overlooking Berta Cáceres and COPIN being awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize, sort of Green Nobel. And we talked about that as a missed chance to bring to light connections between U.S.-based corporations and U.S. aid dollars and the violence against indigenous communities and environmental advocates, among others, in Honduras. I remember that at the time you said that because of her work, Berta's life hung by a thread. Well, that missed opportunity to talk became an ominous silence, it seems, just as it's been made painfully clear how important it is to make just those connections. I'd like to ask you to tell us about Honduras since the assassination and what still stands in the way of justice for Berta Cáceres and for all of those others.
The first thing that stands in the way of justice is that the Honduran government continues to be an imposed government and completely unaccountable. It reigns with full impunity, as have the administrations which preceded it ever since 2009, when, as you say, the U.S. very strongly backed a coup d'etat against Mel Zelaya, who was the last elected government of Honduras. Since then, there have been two other elections, and both have been total shams. They were certified by both the U.S. and Canada, but very few other governments. And so the government pretends to be a democracy and is certainly touted as such up here, but it is in fact a dictatorship and acts like one. The group Global Witness, very well known and well respected international human rights group, just put out another report saying that Honduras continues to be the most dangerous country in the world to be an environmental activist. And certainly the record of the last year proves that to be true. There have been dozens and dozens of assassination attempts, and at least six high-level indigenous activists, just indigenous activists, have been killed or were almost killed just in the past year since Berta Cáceres was killed. The most recent was on February 20th, when José de los Santos Sevilla, who was a leader of the Tolupan indigenous peoples, who are fighting their own battles against theft of their land and resource extraction, was killed. So he is only the last. I don't even have all the figures. They haven't even all been tracked. But what we know is that until there is a change in the actions of the Honduran government and a respect for lives, human rights, and democracy, that indigenous and other environmental actors will not be safe. And we know furthermore that there will not be this change vis-a-vis the Honduran government as long as the U.S. continues to send many, many, many millions of dollars of military aid to Honduras every year.
When Berta Cáceres was killed, the papers like the New York Times covered it, and they talked about how the coup, in fact, had made Honduras more dangerous for activists, but then they left out the U.S. role in the coup. Well, since then, U.S. media have gone, if you will, further. They've actually kind of worked to sell a whole different idea to U.S. citizens about the role that the U.S. has played and is playing in Honduras. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you mentioned the investigation into the events of March 2nd, a year ago, which is when Berta Cáceres was assassinated. Also that night, also in her house, a guest from Mexico, a very powerful indigenous and environmental defender on his own right, Gustavo Castro Soto, was shot and was almost killed. One bullet just missed his skull by a millimeter and took off part of his ear instead. He was also shot in the hand. He was then held illegally by the Honduran government and tortured for 1 month. And we do know, we actually have corroboration from State Department in a written email that they were part of that investigation. Gustavo escaped just by a hair with his life, and he and his family are now living in exile in Europe. So both Gustavo and the family of Berta Cáceres have been trying to have a fair investigation. This investigation, much like Berta's own killing, is really a window into the role of the United States government. And I'll just spin that out for you a little bit because it's part of the story that has been kept from the U.S. public, and certainly the Honduran public. So these two entities, one of them a direct survivor, Gustavo Castro Soto from Mexico. He's actually the director of Friends of the Earth Mexico in Chiapas. And then the family of Berta Cáceres have been trying to gather evidence. The Honduran government has blocked them at all turn, and then last September actually disappeared every shred of evidence that those two parties had spent 6 months collecting. Every document, every photograph, every scrap of paper that had the name of a lead, all disappeared. And, of course, the Honduran government said that it was a theft. Of course, we know that it wasn't. Furthermore, the Honduran government has refused to share any information with these players, including with Berta's very own daughters. And they have refused the offer of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to help out and to come in as a neutral player. That is not at all surprising. And then what the U.S. has done is only surprising in how far it goes. It's so egregious. What the U.S. did has been to arrest through a special unit that is deployed to the Honduran government. The U.S. has made arrests at strategic times of suspects and then has gone to the U.S. Congress, we know this for a fact, and said, oh, no, no, you can't cut off U.S. military aid to Honduras because then there will be no way to go forward with the investigation into Berta Cáceres' killing because the U.S. is the only team that is doing anything serious. The U.S. began doing this immediately after Keith Ellison introduced into Congress last year the Berta Cáceres Human Rights Act, which called on all U.S. military aid to be cut until there was significant improvement in human rights. And so it was immediately in response to this bill going into the U.S. Congress that we then saw the U.S. being so duplicitous and convincing Congress that U.S. aid had to continue flowing.
That would seem to dovetail nicely with the piece that some listeners may remember from August of last year in the New York Times, which was about how the U.S. is involved in Honduras and making things safer in Honduras. I mean, how the most dangerous place on earth got safer was the headline over this Week in Review piece. And the subhead I thought was very interesting. Programs funded by the United States are helping transform Honduras. Who says American power is dead? This seems to me to fit precisely with this effort to fight back against any plans to stop aid by saying, no, the U.S. is actually the force for justice here, including justice for Berta Cáceres.
Yes, that piece that you mentioned that came out last August is really extraordinary, and the same journalist did one the same week on National Public Radio. And both of them show one tiny little micro example of a little community where apparently, who knows if it's true, I doubt it, but where apparently U.S. government funding had helped one small community center. And through this, the journalist extrapolated and said that all of Honduras is getting better, as you say, Janine, thanks to U.S. funding. What's extra interesting about those two pieces is that they appeared just weeks after the president of Honduras, in response to the Berta Cáceres Human Rights Act moving forward in Congress, the president had come up to Washington to do a big PR blitz to ramp up the Honduran government's image using the convenient tool of U.S. media.
We've been speaking with Beverly Bell of the group Other Worlds. They're online at otherworldsarepossible.org. Thank you so much, Beverly Bell, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Janine, I'm delighted to speak with you, and I hope that all U.S. people listening will take responsibility for our government, such as it is, and get in touch with their congresspeople to push for this act that can truly make a difference for all Hondurans.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We take our civilization for granted, but it's fragile and pushing way beyond sustainable limits. How and why do civilizations collapse? In this program, we'll hear from specialists who study the end times of the Indus civilization of India and Pakistan, and the Maya of Central America. Then we'll wrap up with a tough solution for our tough problems. A new book outlines how we could use World War II-style mobilization to save the climate and the ecosphere from their developing collapse. That's three interviews. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get going.
Radio EcoShock.
The history of human civilization is short, relatively, but scientists are exploring how people adapted or collapsed during earlier changes to their climate. That's information that could help us now as we go into a rapid shift. We're going to go back about 5,000 years towards the start of human organization, and that's when the Indus civilization formed around the Indus River of northwest India and now Pakistan. A new article in the journal Current Anthropology draws on studies by the Banaras Hindu University and the University of Cambridge in the UK. We'll talk with the lead author, Dr. Cameron Petrie, from Cambridge's Division of Archaeology. Educated at the University of Sydney, Dr. Petrie went on to specialize in the archaeology of India, Pakistan, and Iran. Cameron Petrie, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Very nice to be speaking to you.
Where was the Indus civilization? Can you put it on a map for us?
Sure. The Indus civilization is now spread across two different countries. The earliest Indus sites were actually discovered in areas which are now parts of Pakistan. So they stretch across quite large parts of the plains of Pakistan. The modern provinces of Sindh and Punjab. And then after independence and partition in the middle part of the 20th century, people started to discover a lot of archaeological sites that were in the borders of modern India as well. So it stretches across parts of the northwest part of India, modern states of Indian Punjab and Haryana. And there's also Indus populations that are known to live in the states of Gujarat as well, which is sort of more strictly western India, I guess.
And how does it compare in time with the pyramids of Egypt or the early settlements of Mesopotamia?
Well, broadly contemporaneous. So the Indus civilization has a long period of development, and the main thrust of that development seems to take place in the 3rd millennium BC, so from around 5,000 years ago. And then around 2,500 BC, the Indus civilization sort of has an urban phase. So we see the development of large urban centers. They're around 80 hectares in size, you know, probably populations more than 50,000 people living together. And that urban period seems to last for around 500 or 600 years. And then I guess in terms of comparing to Mesopotamia and Egypt, I mean, that's at about the same time in Mesopotamia. That's about the same time as the early dynastic period, the end of the sort of first phase of city-states in Mesopotamia. And then when we see people like Sargon of Akkadeh becoming, you know, ruling the first sort of large Mesopotamian, I guess, proto-empire. So, yeah, and then in terms of connections to Egypt, I mean, we're talking broadly contemporaneous with the sort of phases of the major phase of pyramid building in Egypt as well. So the Indus is comparable with the ancient complex societies of Mesopotamia and Egypt in terms of period and complexity, but it's different, of course.
And why do Western people know less about the Indus civilization, and do people from India know more about it?
It's a good question, because I think, you know, we know a lot about Egypt and Mesopotamia, and because it's sort of infiltrated into a lot of the sort of religious texts like the Bible and a lot of the other sorts of textual documents that have survived from antiquity. Whereas the Indus civilization didn't sort of filter through into the sort of Western tradition in terms of documentation. So there's no references to the Indus civilization in any of these ancient texts that survive. And there were little bits and pieces, references to regions to the east that appeared in Mesopotamian texts, but they were only really translated in the 19th and 20th centuries. So it was very much a sort of lost civilization, and it was referred to as a lost civilization when it was sort of rediscovered in the early part of the 20th century. And in many ways, it had sort of slipped out of the consciousness even within India and Pakistan. So there was people recognized that there were these ancient things in the landscape, you know, the giant mounds that existed, and you know, objects were found on the surfaces of these mounds, but it wasn't really clear what they were. And, you know, archaeologists, Indian archaeologists, British archaeologists that were based in India in the 19th century were going out and visiting these archaeological sites and collecting material from them. And some of that material ended up in places like the British Museum, but it wasn't really understood until the early part of the 20th century. And since then, there's been a lot, you know, progressive amounts of archaeological research, and we're gradually sort of filling in the pieces in terms of what we understand.
At the peak, would we recognize these settlements as cities?
It's a good question, and it's a sort of debated question. But purely on the basis of their size, these are sort of, in many ways, massive entities, and you know, they would have had populations of thousands and thousands of people. You know, they typically, the settlements either have large walls around them or they're built up on large platforms, so they would have been very visually striking. And you know, they would have been in the middle of a sort of very, very active landscape where people were interacting with each other. But there's some things that mark them out as being quite different to what we see in Mesopotamia, for example. There's not very many of these Indus cities, especially considering the enormous area that it encompassed. So there's only really a very small number of very, very large centres. Whereas in Mesopotamia, there's lots of centres that exist in a much smaller area. So it's quite clear that there are very different sort of social or urban fabric that exists in these different areas. So I think, yeah, they must have looked like cities in some respects, and they would have certainly been urban if you think of the difference between urban and rural. There's definitely small numbers of urban settlement in the Indus realm, but very much a sort of rural landscape otherwise. So it would have been quite something to encounter this sort of urban centre, I think.
With that setting in mind, Cameron, when did a change in climate arrive for the Indus Valley people?
Well, as far as we can ascertain, around about, say, 2100 BC, so a little, you know, 4,200, 4,100 years ago, there's growing evidence that there was a weakening of the monsoon. So one of the things that marks the Indus out as being quite different to most other early complex societies is that it developed in an area which is quite delicate and nuanced in terms of its environment and its climate. So it's right on the edge of where the winter rain system comes, so a winter rain system that affects the areas of the Mediterranean and the Middle East, and where the Indus River is sort of the limit of that rainfall system. And then it's also at another edge of the Indian monsoon rainfall system as well. So it both benefits from those two rainfall systems and is quite vulnerable to changes in those rainfall systems because, you know, if you don't get enough rain, it's at the edges that it's can have the most effect. So around 4,200, 4,100 years ago, it looks like the monsoon weakened. And as a result of that, there seems to have been less rain. And one of the questions that we're still puzzling over is precisely how long that period of weak rain extended. And on the basis of the evidence that we've got at the moment, we've looked at a series of lakes, dried up lakes in northwestern India. And in one of those lakes, we had very clear evidence that there was a sharp change. So the lake went from being a relatively shallow lake to being effectively an ephemeral lake that only filled up in the rainy season. And that happened around this point in time. So it's clear that the monsoon was weak. It's very, very likely that that weakness was protracted. And some suggestions have been put forward that maybe this period of weak rain was extended for up to 200 years. And, you know, that's a massive extended drought in anyone's language. And it's inevitable that would have had massive effects on local environment and various sorts of other things. But at the moment, we're sort of just getting glimpses of how this is impacting upon the local landscape. And we know from other locations in Bangladesh and in Oman that there was a weakened monsoon in those areas as well. So we're gradually sort of putting the pieces together to work out the patterns of these climate changes that have occurred in the past.
Well, I'm about to mispronounce a word because I don't really know what it means, and I'm asking you, what on earth is a speleothem, and how are they used to assess climate?
You didn't get far off the pronunciation, but a speleothem is effectively it's like a stalagmite that comes out of a cave. And why speleothems are particularly interesting for reconstructing climate is basically they form in relationship to precipitation. So when the rain comes, the water percolates into the ground and it produces deposit formations in caves. And so these stalagmites effectively have the equivalent of tree rings on them that they grow over time. And the reason that that's interesting in terms of climate is because they're actually a very sensitive measure of variation in the amount of rain that comes. So they give you an indication of high rainfall or low rainfall over time. And the other thing that's very good for these sorts of formations is that they can be dated very, very accurately with uranium-thorium dating. And that sort of dating technique is much more accurate than the traditional method that we use in archaeology, which is radiocarbon dating. So radiocarbon dating, you get errors of up to 100 or 200 years, whereas uranium-thorium dating, you get it much, much narrower. And if all the stars are aligned, you can get it down to less than 10 years or down to 3 or 5 years and things like that. So you can actually get very, very sensitive climatic information out of such features in caves.
Now, when the normal crop system failed, did Indus cities break down?
Well, this is one of the questions that we've been really interested in exploring. So I think people have known for a long time that the Indus farmers were quite innovative and clever. And you know, because of these two weather systems, they were quite conscious of growing crops that were suitable for their local environments. So in our area, we were quite conscious about looking at how diverse their farming system was. And some of the things that we discovered was, you know, that it was actually a very, very diverse farming system. And it appears as though they were using more crops than had previously been known. So we discovered that they were using rice in the period before Indus urban cities developed. And then the use of rice continued as well. And they were using millet crops, a range of different millet crops, and both rice and millet can be grown when you get summer rain, and in addition that they're growing wheat and barley and different sorts of lentils and things like that, and all of that can be grown when you get winter rain. So you get with these two different rainfall systems existing, farmers were able to sort of adapt their cropping systems to match the availability of water in different seasons. And I think part of the older sort of idea about the sort of Indus cropping was that people recognised that it was diverse, but there was a general view that a lot of it was focused on the winter crops. So I think some of our research was highlighting that, you know, in actual fact, the diversity is more extensive than was previously thought. And the question then comes, what happens then when the rain becomes weak and people have to sort of make adaptations? And some of the older suggestions was related to the fact that perhaps they made a switch to some of the crops that were more hardy, or they became more diverse over time. But it seems, on the basis of what we've discovered, it was that they were diverse all along. And it seems like that people were always making choices, and so that has all sorts of implications if you think about how a state operates, for example, and whether a state insists that farmers need to grow certain crops or they can grow different crops, and, you know, how people pay taxes and all of these sorts of issues and ideas. So by recognizing that their practices are diverse, it throws up all sorts of interesting questions, and you can ask, you know, how does this society operate and various other things. And then when those sorts of questions are in the mix, then all of a sudden we say, oh, and also what happened if the rain didn't come? So it's very, very interesting, because it means, you know, people are, in some respects, some of these populations and farmers are actually in a situation where they can make choices anyway. So it seems quite likely that they were able to make choices about the crops that they were growing on the basis of the real-time availability of water that was available. So perhaps they were able to make clever choices and be resilient. But one of the things I suspect that becomes difficult when you have less rainfall is to be able to feed large populations. So, you know, my personal view is that perhaps, you know, if the rain becomes weak and you have to engage in, you know, risk mitigation, you have to make decisions about which crops you grow, maybe you grow crops in smaller fields, you can't feed as many people. And this is where, you know, over time, as far as we can work out, it appears as though the Indus cities gradually become depopulated and most of them become abandoned. And it's very possible that this is a sort of a response to the climate change event. You know, it's more difficult to feed people in large populations. It's easier to feed them in smaller populations. So this sort of fits with a bigger archaeological narrative that we see where, you know, it looks like the cities become less popular and we see many more villages appearing in the landscape.
I think there may be another critical difference. This is just a guess on my part between earlier civilizations and ourselves, and that is that in earlier ages, growing food did not stop at city limits. There were crops and animals right throughout wherever anybody lived, and I think that might have helped slow down the process of emptying the cities or given them some resilience that we don't have.
Yeah, I think it's possible that the rural nature of the Indus landscape definitely made it sort of possible for them to sort of make changes and responses. And I think it's also possible that there was always a very close connection between the populations of the city and the populations of the country. And this has been thought about for a long time, actually. You know, scholars going back 40, 50 years have been proposing this as a possibility. And, I mean, you know, so if you think about how populations work today, you know, people do tend to be city dwellers if they're a city dweller. But I think in the Indus world, it's possible that you might have had extended family groups that were connected to, you know, villages. And even today, people all over India and Pakistan have, even though they may well live in a city, they have a home village, in a sense, where their family comes from. So there may well be social mechanisms that exist that allow people to sort of leave a city and still maintain all sorts of social connections. And so, you know, they can spread out into a landscape. You know, the land is very much today, lots of land is being used very, very intensively. And I think when you move towards mechanization, you reduce the number of people that are actually involved in the process. And so more people are being fed off less actual physical labor in some respects. And I think in the past, that wasn't so extreme. So probably when, you know, people move out of a city or they're, you know, inhabiting a countryside more intensively, they're able to engage in smaller scale farming. And perhaps that's sort of quite a successful method to survive in periods of change and stress and other sorts of things.
Do you think there's more knowledge that we can gain from studying the Indus civilization that might help us now that climate change is heating up for us and uncertain effects on our weather?
I think, you know, I'm constantly trying to think of ways in which my research can be relevant other than just thinking of, oh gosh, isn't that interesting? We're learning about the past. And I think it's, you know, in this instance, there's a challenge because I think in many ways agricultural production has transformed so profoundly. So if you've got, you know, an example from the past where people have engaged in sort of successful behavior and activities where they're taking lessons from farming, it's a little bit difficult to apply it directly. But I think some of these issues about diversification and I think in many ways maybe the degree to which the ancient population was carefully in tune with their environment and not so keen perhaps to modify that environment but to live within its limits. And I mean, I think that's a lesson that wouldn't surprise a lot of people in some ways where, you know, for example, in modern India now, there's quite an extreme use of groundwater. So there's a lot of pumping to engage in intensive agriculture. And this results in, you know, the India's ability to support an enormous population. But it also creates incredible stresses on the environment. So I think these sorts of issues are going to become very relevant when it comes, you know, if we have increasing variability in rainfall and we have more extended periods of drought, then you know, some of the big, you know, intensive agricultural projects are going to become very vulnerable. And I think populations are going to really have to think more about the intense way that they use water. And so that sort of approach of, you know, I think being a bit realistic about, you know, the degree to which we can actually apply information from 5,000 years ago is a good word of caution. I think it would be ridiculously ambitious to say, oh yeah, you can just apply this to the modern world. But I think it's an interesting lesson in the sense that people being willing to operate within the limits of the capacity of the land and then perhaps adapting their behavior to suit changes in the environment, I think those are helpful lessons, really.
Indeed. Could you tell us what the Land, Water, and Settlement Project is?
The Land, Water and Settlement Project was something that was established in 2008, and we were given funding from a variety of different funding bodies in 2007, and we set out to really investigate the area of northwestern India and to try and get some understanding about long-term social change, long-term environmental change in this particular region. And partly because this is an area where we have evidence for the Indus civilization as this sort of first phase of urbanism in the subcontinent. And it's also an area where we have evidence for a second period of urbanism, which happens about 2,500 years ago. We see the beginning of a second urban phase. So we were very much interested in looking at long-term social change, long-term environmental change, and trying to see what the relationships were between humans and their environment. And in some ways, I think one of our original aims was to look at the decline of the Indus civilization and to try and see whether there was environmental role played. You know, was there climate change? If so, how did people respond to it? And as the project developed, we came upon some very clear evidence that climate change occurred, and clear evidence for all sorts of different social dynamics and changes, urbanization, deurbanization, shifts in settlement, different decisions being made by local populations. And it was very interesting from our perspective. It was quite clear that the local populations engage with, you know, broader connective networks. They trade over great distances, but they're also very much focused on what's happening in a local sort of setting. So this is, from our perspective, we were really trying to get an understanding of this particular part of India and how it was intersecting with other areas.
And now the Two Rains Project. Who's funding that? What's its aim?
The Two Rains Project was very much a sort of, in some ways, a logical extension and an expansion of what we attempted with the Land, Water, Settlement Project. So we were funded, the Two Rains Project was funded in 2015 by the European Research Council. And this has allowed us to bring in a number of new doctoral students and postdoctoral researchers, and we can sort of, in some respects, expand the research that we're attempting on the ground and also do it a little bit more intensively. And so we're very much focused on this whole idea, the two rainfall systems and the distinctive nature of the Indus environmental context, but then really trying to focus on this question of, does climate change actually cause collapse? That's actually the sort of, in some ways, a reasonably coarse question. But we're really trying to look at whether or not climate change is a sort of driver for these social changes. Well, you know, is climate change a real forcing mechanism? And, I mean, one of the reasons that we're asking that as a question rather than assuming that it is actually the cause is because we know, for example, that the Indus civilization didn't just sort of vanish once this climate change event happened. People don't just sort of run screaming without trying to change things, trying to adapt, trying to be resilient and trying to overcome things. So we really wanted to look at, you know, what are the mechanisms that we can reconstruct and what can we say about the landscape? What can we say about how people lived in that landscape? How did they farm and how did they make decisions? And, you know, some of that is related to how they kept animals and whether they, you know, provided the animals with water even though there wasn't a lot of water available. You know, if they're trying to grow crops, were their crops under stress or were they not under stress? And these sorts of issues where we're really trying to unpack a question about climate change and collapse and really understand it in a little bit more detail rather than just assuming that those things are definitely connected.
Well, worth doing, and you can find out more, listeners, in the paper Adaptation to Variable Environments, Resilience to Climate Change, Investigating Land, Water, and Settlement in the Indus, Northwest India. It was published in the journal Current Anthropology on January 27, 2017. Our guest is the lead author, Dr. Cameron Petrie. He is a reader in South Asian and Iranian archaeology at the University of Cambridge. And you can find links to all this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Cameron, thank you so much for helping us out.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, our special on collapse, how, why, and how to avoid it. Our guide to the collapse of the Mayan civilization is one of the world's experts. Takeshi Inamata is a professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona. He also has a chair in environment and social justice. Dr. Inamata has published books, popular articles, and many key papers on thousands of years of the Maya people. Takeshi Inamata is the lead author of a new paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It's the most accurate yet on when and at what pace social and economic upheaval happened in the Mayan culture. That helps explain how this advanced civilization came apart until the cities were abandoned. Dr. Inamata, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Let's locate ourselves. Where is the Maya site of Sabal that you studied intensively?
Yeah, that's in Guatemala, in the lowland part of the country. So the northern part of Guatemala, close to Mexico, it's a tropical lowland where you have rainforest. And the Sabal is located in the area, pretty close to the border with Mexico.
How many people lived in Sabal, and if we could travel back in time, would we recognize this as a city?
Yes. In its heyday, which is what we call classic period from the 2nd to 9th century, it probably had about 5,000 to 10,000 people. So it was something like city. It depends on what you, how you define city. But it had the ruler, it had the temple, and then it had the plazas where people gathered. So it had lots of these functions of city.
And for this paper, you took a couple of main periods out of that long history of the Maya. When were you studying, really?
It can be divided into two main periods. One is pre-classic period, which is before 2nd AD, and the next one is a classic period, which is from 2nd to 9th century AD. Then, yeah, we studied the end of each of these periods.
Why did you study the end of those periods?
Well, that's always the big question in Maya archaeology. Many centers were abandoned at the end of each of these periods. That has been a major focus of debate and studies.
Well, you know, in our hypermodern civilization, a lot of my listeners worry about collapse, and there are places on Reddit where you can just talk about collapse. They have different reasons why they think it could happen, and one of the big debates is whether civilizations tend to break up quickly or do they fade away slowly. What is your estimate from the times that you studied in this paper?
So we think that the key is chronology and dating. So when you have coarse chronology of your dating is not very precise, the whole process looks very gradual. Most people thought that the classic collapse, for example, happened over a century. But when you see, when you have more refined chronology, then you can see much more detailed social changes that happens within this period of what we call collapse. We have a period of fast decline, political decline, followed by limited recovery. Then we have a major abandonment of many cities. Then some cities comes back and had the recovery, but then many of them also had final abandonment.
Well, as you're aware, a series of papers over the last dozen years suggest a long-lasting drought created tensions that led to regional wars. You've cited a half dozen climate-leaning studies in your paper references. Do you think climate change was one factor that helped the Mayan civilization collapse?
That's still an open question. So by now, we have enough evidence that indicates that there were some droughts at each of those periods of collapse. But was it the main cause of the collapse? That's still a question. Then we see our work was a sort of step towards getting a better answer to this question. At the beginning, so we have a initial political decline, which seems to be related to social problems. We see the intensification of warfare, and then people started to live in fortified locations. Then we have this major episode of abandonment, which may be related to drought. So picture may be pretty complex, and then we still need more work. But by refining this kind of chronology, we hope that we can get to clearer answers.
Well, we do need to understand how climate change affects civilizations because of our own pressing needs in the fossil fuel age. But I think you might agree we don't want to let that blind us or distort our view when we look into the past to see what happened.
Yeah, that's an important point. But the same problem is happening, well, particularly in this area. And another important factor is the deforestation. And then right now, deforestation is happening in this area of Guatemala and then adjacent areas. Then these kind of problem may have led to social problems. Then in that sense, it's probably important to study what happened in the past in order to think about today's problems too.
And this paper compares two collapses of the Maya. The first was during the time of the Roman Empire, and the second during the Dark Ages in Europe. What did the two Maya collapses have in common?
We looked at the two events, two periods of collapse, at the end of pre-classic period, and then the other one at the end of classic period. But in both cases, we find that there was those smaller episodes or waves of political decline. First, there was some political decline, and then recovery, and then major episode of abandonment, then some recovery, and then final abandonment. So this pattern happened in both cases, at the end of pre-classic period and then at the end of the classic period. So this is probably telling us something very important about the nature of social change and then possibly about the causes of these changes. Although we don't know exactly what they were, but we think that this is giving us important hints.
And yet, your paper finds these two similar collapses produced very different outcomes, and I think there's a critical lesson there. Please talk to us about the two different routes after the collapse.
Yes, that's the interesting part. So during or after the pre-classic collapse, some major centers declined and got abandoned, but some survived, and then those surviving ones led to the emergence of Maya dynasties. So the time of collapse was the time of the establishment of Maya kingship. Then you get into this heyday of Maya civilization, which is the classic period. But at the end of classic period, again, many centers or cities were abandoned, but that really marked the end of certain kind of kingship, what we call divine kingship. Then Maya civilization continued after the classic period and the Maya. There are still lots of Maya people today in Guatemala and Mexico and other countries. And then they did, after the classic period, they did have some kind of kingship, but it was very different, not so heavily based on religious leadership. And then there seems to have been some important political change happened with the classic collapse.
I find this fascinating because if the international order does break down or the grid fails for some reason, some of us hope for new local governments and greater freedom, and others fear the multi-billionaire families will continue as dynasties ruling during another dark age. You've taken a special interest in the timing and development of great dynasties in Mayan culture. Why is that important?
Basically, we are looking at the change in political system and then kingship or dynasty is really the core of this political system in Maya society. So in a broader sense, we are interested in how political organization change, and in that sense, that relates to political change that happen in today's world, too.
And the Maya had many gifts. They had a written language, mathematics, astronomy, and amazing architecture. But they also had a reputation for brutality. What were those practices, and was that built into the religion of power?
I don't want to emphasize too much this aspect of brutality. Well, every civilization had that aspect. Almost every society was involved in warfare, some form of violence. And the Maya had a unique form of violence, including human sacrifice. But it doesn't mean that the Maya people are more brutal or violent than other people. I see it as really the aspect of every civilization, including our own society.
Well, certainly the Romans were a brutal people, and yes, we've had our share of wars and bombings. So why do you think that North Americans know more about Greece and Rome than the great Maya civilization that flourished right on this continent?
Yes, that's a good question. Partly because we didn't know too much about the Maya civilization. We couldn't read glyphs. So we didn't know much about the history of Maya people. But now we have much more archaeological studies, and then we can read text and glyph, Maya glyphs. Then we know much more about the Maya civilization these days. Also, it may relate to today's status of Maya people. Maya people has been economically disadvantageous positions. I think it is important to learn their culture and their historical heritage, and that should probably relate to the respect for those people who live in this area today.
Yes, the Chiapas Rebellion in southern Mexico traced some of its roots to the Maya people.
Yes, that's another area that the Maya people still live, and there are lots of political issues in those areas. Guatemala had civil war, which was very much tied to this division between the indigenous people and the government.
Can you recommend books, even fiction books, that give us a realistic picture of Maya history and what it would be like to live in those times?
I did one book with my colleague Steve Houston. It's called The Classic Maya, which gives pretty much an overview of this civilization.
And when you do your work in the field, do you sometimes think about lessons for modern times?
As we talked about, Maya people may have faced the similar problems and challenges that we face today, including the climate change, and also the problem of deforestation, and then also the problem of political violence and warfare. So I'm not saying that we can get the direct lesson for today's world, but it is important to know about the past in order to think about today and the future.
Is there still a lot of work to be done to solve this mystery of what happened to the Maya?
Certainly. I think we are making a good progress, but still we need lots of work. And then also one concern is that lots of archaeological sites are being destroyed, along with deforestation and economic development. Then in that case, all the information is gone, it's lost forever. So that's one concern.
We've been discussing the new paper titled High Precision Radiocarbon Dating of Political Collapse and Dynastic Origins at the Maya Site of Ceibal, Guatemala. It was published December 19, 2016 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Our guest is the lead author, Professor Takeshi Inamata, from the Department of Anthropology at the University of Arizona. You can find links to Professor Inamata and the science we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Takeshi, thank you so much for helping us understand.
Thank you very much.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website, We're at ecoshock.org.
Scientists and pundits suggest we need World War II-style mobilization to fight climate change. But what will it really take if we had the will to save ourselves from devastating climate change? What could we do? That's the task of a new book from Dr. Lawrence L. Delina. He's a postdoctoral associate at the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future. That's at Boston University. Lawrence is also the Rachel Carson Fellow at LMU University in Germany. From Munich, Lawrence Delina, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex. Pleasure to be in your radio show.
Well, yes, we're going to talk about your book, Strategies for Rapid Climate Mitigation, Wartime Mobilization as a Model for Action. And there is a question mark at the end of that title. Why?
That's actually intentional. I am offering the book as a critical take of the lessons and strategies for wartime mobilization as a possible policy model for rapid climate mitigation. That is, whether those moments in history can actually provide us lenses by which we, as contemporary human beings, can address the biggest challenge of our time, climate change. And the question mark at the end of the book subtitle signals that that particular critical take.
And the book comes with a foreword by one of my climate heroes, Dr. Hans Schellenhuber. And early on, he dared to ask the question, what if we go beyond 4 degrees C of heating? There were two conferences on that. Lawrence, do you know John Schellenhuber, and what does his foreword offer us?
I haven't personally met John yet, but I hope to make his acquaintance while I'm in Germany. John wrote the foreword to my book a few days after the Paris Agreement came out in December of 2015, and about 6 months after the release of Pope Francis' encyclical Laudato Si, which John presented in Vatican that June that year. In his foreword to my book, John talks about the main actors in what he calls a 3D drama of saving the world. First of these is disasters that teach people around the world that climate change is no joke and no fun. Second is discovery or innovation enabling leap forwards in technologies. And third is dignity or the morality of preserving the livelihoods of our brothers and sisters, which is basically the thrust of the Pope's encyclical.
That sounds pretty interesting to me, but strange as it sounds, I'm going to skip your first chapter on the awful things that will happen if we continue with fossil power. We'll probably get to that at some point. But you do tackle next the gritty question of whether we can find enough renewable energy in time to save us from catastrophic climate change. In general, what did you find?
My major finding is that the technology for transitioning towards a global, low-carbon, sustainable economy is ready. This includes technically piloted and demonstrated wind, water, and sunlight systems, which are also fast becoming economically affordable. Now, there is a preponderance of studies, models, and scenarios that points to this possibility. And I've mentioned the global nature of a 100% renewable energy future, but a number of studies have also emerged as of late showing the specifics on how every country on Earth can actually progress in their transitions using only the renewable energy technologies that we already have.
And your scenario for doing what we need is called the Rapid Mitigation Agreement. Please tell us about that.
The agreement sets the stage for achieving deep national cuts in emissions with a window for auditing national achievements. The agreement makes it very clear that we want to achieve a global target of close to zero emissions from the energy sector within 30 years, but not later than 2035 for richer emission states, which are historically at their highest. For developing states, the target will be within 40 years, but not later than 2050. So this particularly ensures that by mid-century, 2050, global emissions have peaked and will be declining really, really steeply. The agreement is different from what we currently have, Paris Agreement, in that the proposed agreement would address free riding by bluntly assigning targets and timetables in a top-down scheme. Now, that approach may appear pathetic to many, especially in the context of the bottom-up approach that generally led to the Paris Agreement. But the proposal is to be appreciated in the context of a wartime approach, where during the war, belligerent nations have actually spent up to 70% of their GDP on military.
what are we going to do about rogue countries? Well, we could almost count the United States in that because they signed up for the Paris Climate Agreement and now threaten to withdraw from it, and they're pushing more fossil fuel production. How will we handle that after the Rapid Mitigation Agreement is signed?
So what makes the proposed Rapid Mitigation Agreement different in that? Here, I called for an audit mechanism that would reduce the possibility that some nations might break off it and to lay sanctions for countries that fail to meet the targets. To illustrate this, I called on that historical moment in Casablanca in January 1943, during which the Second World War actually peaked.
And what was that agreement? I'm sorry, I don't know my history on that.
So the 1943 Casablanca Agreement between Allied nations included a text by which Allied leaders who that time, January 1943, met at Casablanca in then France, Morocco, and they decided that the only way to ensure post-war peace was to actually adopt a policy of non-conditional surrender. So this policy was made to avoid a situation that followed the First World War, where large segments of German society supported the position that Germany was not defeated militarily, hence the German rearmament and consequently the violation of the Treaty of Versailles. What we don't want to occur is another Treaty of Versailles-like infraction happening in the period of rapid mitigation, during which the rapid climate mitigation is in effect. And using the Casablanca Agreement as a model, the rapid mitigation agreement has to do at least four key things. The first is to establish mandatory emission cuts to ensure a 100% renewable energy regime before 2050. Second is to establish an assessed contributions approach to a multilateral fund to support the transition of developing countries. Third is to establish a global monitoring mechanism that would periodically review mitigation targets. And fourth, to establish penalties for non-adherence or secession from the agreement through trade sanctions, diplomatic sanctions, reduced foreign aid, and censure at international forums.
Now, Lawrence Delina, let's talk about motivation. Science is pretty clear there will be widespread and devastating climate events if we continue to load up the atmosphere with greenhouse gases. But beyond that sort of gradual building storm, if you will, there are also some black swan events. What are some of those less likely but powerful climate signals we might see?
You are very right. The science is very clear on the devastating and large-scale impacts of global climate change. Now, black swans actually refer to those tail events in your bell-shaped probability distribution curves, if you remember your Statistics 101. In normal bell curves, these tail events signify unlikely outcomes. Outcomes from climate impacts, however, have high likelihood, meaning you can have fatter tails. This means that we can have, in an unchecked climate change, more of gray swans or even the more familiar white swans. Now, these events are highly catastrophic. And according to one analysis, they include the following: the melting of the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet, a dieback of the Amazon rainforest, and more persistent El Nino regimes. Now, how likely these events are to happen? The scientists estimate that at least one of these tipping points or tipping events will be triggered in a temperature increase of up to 2 degrees Celsius. That's very close. And more than one of these events can actually occur in a temperature increase of 4 degrees Celsius. Now, a simpler reading would say that these events are not totally remote.
I know that Russia experienced severe fires and heat waves in 2010, and they still are fossil pushers, really. And we had tens of thousands die in the French heat wave, and much of Pakistan was flooded. Hurricane Sandy cost billions. And yet we're still not motivated, apparently. What will it take and what could happen that would send the world a big enough signal?
In the book, I discussed that climate-related events, however catastrophic they are, those black swans, which are actually white swans, are not guarantees that governments will act aggressively against climate change. So that is one of the many aspects where the analogy between wartime mobilization and climate mobilization diverges and becomes a little bit problematic. Whereas wartime mobilization was triggered by aggressive threats on territories such as the attack on Pearl Harbor and Manila, which was then under American control, which eventually triggered the United States mobilization for war, the stimuli for a rapid mitigation program are very hard to predict. I would like to believe that signals would come from a variety of sources, This would include extreme climate events for sure, but you can also discount the role of a stronger climate action movement.
Well, I know that the World War II economy depended on an enormous expansion of public debt. And even before the climate challenge, we already have stupendous debt at almost every level of government and even personally. Is there really any room for more debt without destroying completely the value of money? Is debt part of the program that you envision?
You are right. The Second World War ushered in an unprecedented volume of public debt. Contrary to concerns over stupendous public debt, however, it is the growth and acceleration of private debt that we should be worried about. This is because private debt drives asset price inflation or bubbles, which always burst, and in effect, they cause economic destruction and financial disruption. Private debt insurance, not public borrowing per se, should be controlled. This doesn't mean, however, that we continue on borrowing till kingdom come. Societies must be emancipated from the constraints of debt, including those made by the governments. As I have described in the book, public borrowing to finance the sustainable energy transition has to come as a complement to taxation. Taxing carbon polluters remain a key policy I am advancing in the book, and I have also discussed several proposals for new forms of taxation, including a progressive tax that can be levied on consumption. But taxes and borrowing are but two ways to fund the transition or the rapid mitigation project. There's still the need to source money beyond these traditional mechanisms. I have listed a number of approaches, ways, and means in the book, but that include taking out fossil fuel subsidies and revisiting national budget items apportioned for defense and wars and realigning them to the purposes of the transition.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, author and scholar, Dr. Lawrence Delina. We're talking about using World War II mobilization as a model to combat climate change. One of the hallmarks of World War II, Lawrence, I think, in the United States and Canada, even more in Britain and Germany, was rationing of consumer goods. Came right down to things like sugar and butter, which were needed to feed the troops. I still think we need to ration consumer goods. Everything we buy contains embedded carbon to produce and transport it and all that. And we need to buy a heck of a lot less, I think, to get emissions down. Would you agree with that?
I agree. Rationing was a hallmark of wartime mobilization, as it is a way to solicit everyone's contribution to the war effort. I haven't discussed rationing of consumer books in the book, as my focus was on the industrial mobilization part. But rationing is key in climate mitigation, especially in envisaging strategies that revisit the way we consume things, which has obvious effects on our emission profiles. Curtailing excessive consumption is essential if we are to effectively address the climate challenge. And you're right, carbon is embedded in all things we do, all things we make, and things we eat. The solutions to anthropogenic global climate change comprise urgent, traumatic, large-scale, and transformative changes in areas beyond how we obtain and consume energy. And a comprehensive approach to effective mitigation ideally involves strategies to decelerate total global economic activity and consumption. In that regard, there is much to learn from wartime rationing.
Your book, Strategies for Rapid Climate Mitigation, doesn't avoid the hardest questions, and a big one is the whole problem of government control and trust in government. And as we've just seen in the American elections, trust in government seems to be at an all-time low, just when we need it most to save the climate. How can we overcome that?
The hardest aspect of climate mobilization is non-technical. It's the social and the political. And as I've mentioned, the technology is ready, waiting to be deployed in the large scale. And it takes staged, structured, planned, and coordinated response to do just that. It is in that area of coordination and marshalling the necessary resources that the governments have historically been effective. These lapses in the book, and use them regardless, to provide us lessons with how governments can possibly mobilize their agencies effectively in the context of rapid climate mitigation. During the war, we saw how the likes of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, providing the much-needed political will and leadership to prosecute wartime efforts and to mobilize industries for wartime. How we wish we could have the same traits from our leaders today. But things are very different nowadays. Trust in government, as you have mentioned, is indeed at an all-time low. We saw that in the American elections of November 2016. We constantly saw it pointing almost all over the world. citizens are losing trust in their governments, more so in their leaders. I don't really have a prescription on how to overcome that challenge in governance. But I take my optimism from a number of initiatives from the local, from the grassroots. The rapid mitigation project, regardless of whether it is a top-down approach, will still need strong citizen engagement. The histories of many successful and violent movements provide us mirrors on how this could be done. That actually is the second strand of my research and one which I am currently developing as a new project here at the Rachel Carson Center. This is a bit about this this follow-up project. I try to look at strategies on strengthening the climate action movement from lessons of many histories, including the People Power Revolution in my country, the Philippines, the struggle for independence in India, and the modern American civil rights movements, among others. What I'm trying to say here is that these moments of histories can actually provide us new strategies for driving rapid climate mitigation. And that can be through climate activism, traditionally construed as people, for example, shouting on the streets and doing civil disobedience. On the other hand, it can also be through prefigurative means, such as people organizing themselves into cooperatives to build solar or wind farms.
I contacted you precisely because so many people have put forward the wartime model as a way to fight climate change, and you ended the title with a question mark. What do you think in the end? Were you able to develop a model that could work in the real world?
What I learned is that, yes, there are opportunities for learning from the industrial mobilization for Second World War and possibly apply those lessons in the context of rapid mobilization for climate change. I have shown that strategies can be developed in terms of mobilizing finance, labor, and administrative resources to quickly deploy renewable energy technologies. This is the model that I think can work in the real world. However, there are caveats to the analogy. We have to be actually cautious if we are to adopt similar wartime strategies in addressing climate change. We don't want our government to become a coercive one, although we are seeing a lot of governments today turning into one. In that regard, I propose in the book, and this is part of the model, the creation of an equally strong institution to ensure that what governments do are in line with the objectives of rapid mitigation. And that is to quickly replace fossil fuel systems with renewable ones using energy generated from wind, water, and solar, and nothing else. Now, there is no guarantee that governments would actually do that. I raise in the book the likelihood that governments would actually elect to do large-scale risk engineering to possibly build walls to keep away climate refugees and others. Adaptation, of course, is important, but that misses the opportunity to address the challenge at its root causes, and that is to rapidly zero out emissions.
As we finish up, is there anything else you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Yes, the wartime model for rapid climate mitigation is strong in one sense. At the same time, it has limitations. I accept that there will be critiques and questions about the technical, social, or political assumptions I made in the book. Many of the strategies for rapid climate mitigation I discussed there are unattractive, controversial alternatives, especially if viewed in a predominantly market-oriented frame of mind. Many of the strategies I presented in the book are highly idealized and utopian, even for progressives. And for liberals, they can be considered highly intrusive. But I would like to invite everyone listening to us to consider a very short thought experiment. When climate impacts hit us in a scale, scope, and intensity beyond our expectations, beyond our current imaginations, during such events, what do you think will government do? Most likely than not, they will expand their power and most possibly intrude into our private lives. Now, we have a choice. Shall we wait for that situation to pan out and have confused governments responding to forced migrations, conflicts, famines, or we use the contingency strategies this book is advancing, proceed and activate an organized government to mobilize resources for rapid mitigation within a bounded portfolio of plans and activities with oversight built into it. Now, I'm not really a fan of both, but the latter strikes me as the lesser of the two evils.
I completely understand. We've been speaking with Lawrence Delina, educated in the Philippines, New Zealand, and Australia. Lawrence has been a visiting scholar at the Harvard Kennedy School and an advisor for the United Nations. He studies the longer-range future at Boston University. He's currently at LMU Munich. Lawrence Delina's new book, published by Routledge, is Strategies for Rapid Climate Mitigation, Wartime Mobilization as a Model for Action. I'll put links for you to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Plus, you can download any of our past programs for free. Pass it on. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
I think we might have the poet Rob Roth on the line. Are you there, Rob?
Sam, Phil, good to hear from you.
Well, we're glad to get you. I didn't mean to make you endure an editorial, but thank you very much for your patience. Phil Conlon tells me that you are best described as a Southwestern Ontario poet. You've published many great books of poems, and tell us the title of your latest one, and I want to ask you about a poem that you've written in connection with another book. But what is the latest, your latest book?
The last book I did, Phil, was called Hard Times. Mm-hmm. I wasn't the first person to publish a book with that title.
Yeah, but it's a good, it's very apropos.
It was very true to what I was writing about.
Yeah. Now, I understand that you have been looking at a book that we've been wanting to talk about on this show, and you seem to be the ideal figure to tell us about it. It's called Songs Upon the Rivers, The Buried History of the French-Speaking Canadians and Métis from the Great Lakes and the Mississippi Across the Pacific. It's written by Robert Fox Curran, Michael Bouchard, and Sebastian Mallette. And of course, I know you're from Windsor. Pardon me?
London.
London?
Yeah.
Well, you're partly right.
That's a voice Phil Conlon.
I lived in Windsor when I was young.
I think of you as from Windsor, but okay. But, well, to make that association, Windsor and Detroit, they have this river called the Strait, named by the French, which people often forget. I just wondered maybe that entered into your mind when you
it
began to think
did.
About it.
That's one of the things I really liked about this book. As a kid, I remember all the French names in Windsor, streets like Oulette, and we lived just up the road from, we called it Grand Marais, but it's the French words again, and there was Belle Isle, and the city of Detroit's name, as you just said, is a French name. Mm-hmm. So this book filled in a lot of history for me that I really wasn't that aware of.
Mm-hmm. What sort of, I think it is a common problem, as you point out. We have it's rather like I grew up in California, where all the names are Spanish, and which we immediately mispronounce. But you know, it tells you something about history. These places used to be something. There were other people here, other governments, other economies. So, what struck you about the kind of details in this book? What stood out for you?
Well, for me, it was really reestablishing a lost history, because it's right in the title of the book, but it reestablishes the role of the French and Métis people, who were essential to the history of North America since the Europeans arrived, because the entire economy began in the fur trade years, and they carried French culture, Métis culture, across North America, and the book fills in a lot of that story so that we begin to understand where names like St. Louis came from, a major American city. It's the French word.
Yes.
And we don't know the history often of how this came to be. So this book, for me, it sort of filled in that part of history that tends to be missing.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. Of course, you have the Detroit. You have the Mississippi River, and at the top, very close to the big Mississippi's headwaters, is Detroit. And of course, Mississippi exits into the ocean at New Orleans. Tells you a lot of French things happen.
Yeah.
I once read an account of Abraham Lincoln having a trial outside Chicago, and he was acting on behalf of a priest who was in fighting with the church, and his community was supporting him. And everybody who testified in French, and Lincoln insisted that they should, and that a translator be provided. So that would have been about 1850.
Yeah.
So everybody, all the witnesses, speaking French. Now, I understand you wrote a poem where you that has to do with this matter. Were you inspired by the book itself, or?
Yes, I was. I'm living in Owen Sound these days, up on Georgian Bay, mm-hmm. and actually, right where I live, along the shore, were Métis homes that have been. There were Métis families along the shore of Owen Sound Bay, which leads into Georgian Bay, since the 1800s. And at the time of the Riel Rebellion in 1885, ships came back carrying the troops home, troops sent from Ontario, many were volunteers, from fighting to put down the Riel Rebellion, the Northwest Rebellion, and they arrived in Owen Sound. And there was a big celebration here in Owen Sound at the time. And I got to thinking, for a couple of years I've been thinking, well, I wonder what the Métis families along the shore were thinking when those ships came in. But I could never get my head around it properly. And reading the book sort of crystallized the thoughts for me, and that's sort of how the poem came about.
Well, this poem, I understand it was read at a gathering of Métis, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes.
Your poem, they chose to tell us about that.
Well, in Owen Sound, there is a branch of the Métis Nation of Ontario. It's the Great Lake Métis Council. And I've, because of where I'm living, I've done a fair bit of writing about families in this area, and a number of them were Métis. And so I've had contact with the organization, so when I showed the poem to them, they chose to read it at the Louis Riel Day celebration this year here in Owen Sound.
You must have been proud of that.
I was.
Were you in attendance, or this is simply
talking? I was asked to read it, but I was headed off to Ottawa to see my daughter, and I couldn't, so one of the members of the organization read it.
You're like Bob Dylan. You had a conflict of schedule. You couldn't give the Nobel Prize.
Okay.
Poets are like that. Can you read the poem for us?
Sure, I could.
We really appreciate it.
Okay.
I'll leave the rest to you.
Okay. The poem is called French Village, and actually along the shore here in Owen Sound, at one time the area where the French-speaking Métis family lived, they were mainly fishermen, was called the French Village. French Village. A ship came into Owen Sound. The crowd gave it a loud ovation. Word was out they'd laid to rest Riel's half-breed nation. John MacDonald had a dream of cart and travois swept away. Soon the buffalo were gone. Into the west there came a train. No one knows for certain, as the noose was firmly tied, if those French fishermen wept when Louis Riel died. The trees are like a Métis sash, red, green, orange, interwoven. The high bluffs offer shelter. Log cabins stand below them. So that's it.
Well, that's it. Thank you very much. I could see why they chose to read. I hope that they put that on some sort of marker, because you told us something I don't think many of us knew, that there was a Métis community in Owen Sound.
Yes, there is, and it's going to be recognized this year. They're putting up a plaque. The city is finally going to put a plaque along the shore in this area. It used to be known as Mud Town. It's quite a poor area of town, and there's now going to be recognition of the Métis presence along the shore.
Well, we're very glad to hear about that. I'll do editing on air or producing. Maybe we could get a copy of the poem. We would be, and we'll make sure that we post it on our site for the occasion of this marker.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Yeah. And I'd like, I should say that Robin Philpott at Baraka Books, Baraka Books published this book, Songs Upon the Rivers, and Robin did put the poem on the website for Baraka Books. And so I was sort of thrilled because I know the authors of the books got to read my poem after I had a chance to read their book.
Now, that's the best kind of communications.
Yes, it is.
Rob Roth, we're really glad we could talk to you. I think we can now call you a sound poet. You're at Owen Sound.
So okay.
a poet of the sound.
Yeah.
And, well, we're very grateful. And like you, I hope people turn to this book. And thanks for telling us that we can find that poem now. Any our listeners can go to Baraka Books. It's up there at the moment, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Well, Rob Roth, thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much, Phil. It's good to hear from you, and say hi to my other Phil friend there.
Yes, he's nodding, so
I heard your hi there, Rob. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Talk again soon.
Bye.
Rob Roth, and he's talking about the book, Songs Upon the River, Rivers, plural, pardon me, The Buried History of the French-Speaking Canadians and Métis from the Great Lakes and the Mississippi across to the Pacific, and that's Robert Foxcorin, Michel Bouchard, Sebastian Millette. I think Sebastian just hung up. And an important book to get. This thing about the presence of the French in North America, it's important. You know, just across, not far from Windsor, where Bob Roth lived, that was where one of the big battles of the War of 1812 happened. It was actually quite an ugly moment. And the name of the place of the battle was French Town. That was the name of the location when the battle happened. Actually, the majority of the population in that area, European, if we can say that, were not English or American, but they were French. And they were in an awkward position because they had to watch the Anglos and the Americans fight each other and wonder what was going to happen to them.
Yeah, you know, when you interviewed Robin Philpott about this book, he emphasized that those people were French in the same way that the Americans were English. They were people from here. I mean, this was their continent. They were born here and stuff. But yeah, they had moved out to populate the rest of the continent, which is what the Americans wanted to do. But the Americans didn't really have in mind having all these French speakers, you know, establishing the local culture. But so much of the U.S. Midwest, Wisconsin and Iowa and Missouri, were French.
Des Moines.
Yeah. Des Moines. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Of course. Yeah, yeah. No, it's
and Ohio even, right? I think. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and of course the relations were entirely different. But the French native relations were quite different than the Americans. Americans came to farm, and the French had come to trade. So a different economy with different ugly consequences. I can't resist mentioning here at the end of the show, the Globe and Mail today quoted some of these people who attacked the buses the buses were to transport Syrians who were encircled by terrorists. And so the terrorists burned the buses. And so the Globe and Mail quotes one of those who burned the buses. And they said, the buses that came to evacuate the apostates have been burned. I've had trouble reading this. Basically it says, the pigs, the Shiite pigs, will not be allowed to leave. So these they turned out the lights in Paris for these people. And there's no confusion about that. France wants us to worry about the armed gang and not celebrate the liberation, which is why, by the way, the current government of France is going to be eliminated quickly in the next election. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Charlotte and Ian, thank you all both very much. We'll see you next week.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Benjamin Schreiber of Friends of the Earth, who discusses the Trump administration's plan to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency through deep budget cuts and staff layoffs. Shannon Jackson, executive director of Our Revolution, a Bernie Sanders campaign offshoot, who reflects on the defeat of Keith Ellison, his group's endorsed candidate, to lead the Democratic Party. And Julie Richards, an Oglala Lakota anti-pipeline activist and founder of the group Mothers Against Meth Alliance, who talks about the link between the oil industry and drug addiction plaguing indigenous communities in the Northern Plains. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After 3 years of bloody civil war in South Sudan, the United Nations has declared a famine in the East African nation. 100,000 people now face the immediate threat of starvation, with a million more at risk for famine. The ongoing crisis has intensified since the South Sudan government blocked aid shipments to hard-hit regions in the country. Many farmers have stopped planting crops due to rising violence. Joyce Luma, South Sudan director for the World Food Program, asserted the famine is man-made. There is only so much humanitarian assistance can achieve in the absence of meaningful peace and security. The upsurge in violence that began last July undermined the planting of crops in previously peaceful and productive regions. Inflation soared to 800%, and many village markets closed. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council refused to impose an arms embargo on South Sudan, which could have reduced the violence. According to Foreign Policy magazine, now UN officials worry that without a massive influx of aid, food stocks could be empty by June. The emergency in South Sudan has triggered Africa's most serious refugee crisis, as 1.5 million people have fled across the border seeking refuge in Uganda. President Donald Trump withdrew the United States' longstanding support of a two-state solution that many hoped would bring peace to Israel and Palestine. During a joint appearance with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Trump showed little interest in endorsing any formula for Middle East peace. Israeli Education Minister Naftali Bennett wants to extend Israel's sovereignty over 60% of the West Bank. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the plan calls for 80,000 Palestinians to be granted residency in the new district. Other Palestinians would be forced to live in autonomous areas under Israeli control. This is seen by many observers as a first step for Israel to formally annex the West Bank, which Palestinian and world leaders maintain would establish an official apartheid system in Israel. As the Trump administration rolls back transgender rights for students, leading American corporations like Walmart, Chevron, Apple, and General Electric have won high praise for establishing inclusionary policies toward the LGBTQ community. This comes in the face of attacks by social conservatives over so-called bathroom bills that they support in states including North Carolina and Texas. According to the Human Rights Campaign, 517 major corporations received 100% ratings in the 2017 Corporate Equality Index. It was the largest one-year jump in workplace equity for LGBTQ employees since the ratings were launched in 2002. Top employers now offer their workers transgender-inclusive health coverage. In addition, over 80% of Fortune 500 companies have adopted gender identity protections. According to the Christian Science Monitor, adopting progressive employment policies and strong stands on LGBTQ issues is a key strategy to attract creative and younger employees, as well as to boost their corporate image. Still, many transgender people fear workplace discrimination. A survey by the Center for Transgender Equality found 30% of transgender people say they were terminated or denied a promotion because of gender identity. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Among President Trump's cabinet appointees and staff are a long list of climate change deniers and individuals with very close ties to the fossil fuel industry. The real estate billionaire and reality TV star sent a clear message to America and the world when he chose Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt, a dedicated ally of the oil and gas industry, to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. During his time as Oklahoma's Attorney General, he filed 14 lawsuits against the EPA, some of which are still ongoing, and he generally took a stand against many EPA air and water quality standards. On February 17th, Pruitt's nomination was approved by the U.S. Senate by a vote of 52-46. During his confirmation hearing, it came to light that Pruitt had been illegally withholding some 7,500 pages of emails. But after his confirmation, and an Oklahoma judge's ruling that forced Pruitt to release those emails, it was revealed to what extent his office had closely collaborated with the fossil fuel industry on legal strategies to undermine federal efforts to regulate carbon and greenhouse gas emissions linked to climate change. On February 28th, President Trump signed an executive order directing Pruitt and the EPA to start rolling back the Obama-era Clean Water Rule that protects water sources from pollution. Your reporter spoke with Ben Schreiber, senior political strategist with the group Friends of the Earth, who discusses his group's response to the Senate confirmation of Scott Pruitt to head the EPA and how environmental groups plan to counter the Trump-Pruitt plan to broadly dismantle EPA regulations through deep budget cuts and staff layoffs.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that Donald Trump installed Scott Pruitt into EPA to dismantle the agency from within. And what we heard is that the outline of the budget that Trump has submitted calls for an increase in military spending by $54 billion and a cut of the EPA budget by 25%, including a 20% reduction in staff. So we're talking about a massive, massive cut of the EPA budget, which would be $6.1 billion. So, you know, we're talking about cutting a relatively small agency to boost up our defense spending, and it's a drop in the bucket compared to what we spend on defense. I think the other thing that's really come to light is that in the confirmation process, Scott Pruitt made it clear that you know, he thought that EPA had the authority and the obligation to regulate greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act. And the Supreme Court has ruled as much. Basically, as soon as the confirmation process was over, he gave a speech at CPAC, the conservative gathering that was happening here in Washington, and he basically raised questions about whether or not EPA has the authority to regulate greenhouse gases. And so he brought into question, you know, what has been decided in by the Supreme Court in Massachusetts versus EPA. And it's pretty clear that, you know, Donald Trump and Scott Pruitt are at least going to consider ending regulation of greenhouse gases in the United States.
That would presumably result in a court fight. Is that right?
For sure. There will definitely be a court fight. You know, also, they're talking about rolling back the Clean Power Plan, President Obama's first step to regulating emissions from power plants here in the United States.
Now, what about the Paris Climate agreement, the international agreement that Barack Obama signed. What does it look like in terms of the Trump agenda there?
Yeah, so there have been a lot of rumblings that, Donald Trump will actually remove the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. He sort of hinted as much on the campaign trail. He hasn't really made any signals about that since taking over the White House. I think there's two thoughts about this. One is that he's decided that actually it's more strategic to stay within the framework and actually dismantle it from within, and that by withdrawing the United States, we will no longer be parties to the agreement, and he will have less influence over the overall process. So maybe that's his tactic. The other option is he just hasn't gotten around to it yet. One thing that did happen is that the State Department announced that they're going to be sending a delegation to Bonn for the intersessional that's coming up. And so right now the U.S. is actually moving forward as if they're going to continue to participate in the Paris process.
So, Ben, as you and your colleagues and other environmental organizations around the country take stock of what the Trump administration agenda here is on the environment, what's some of the strategy that you're talking about or have actually maybe even initiated to counter what Trump is doing here?
Yeah. So I think that the first thing, and you sort of alluded to it before, is this is if this budget passes. And this budget is not going to pass without the help of Democrats, because there is an appropriations process and money for EPA will have to be appropriated. We are hoping that Senate Democrats in particular hold a strong line and stand up for clean air and clean water and make it clear that this budget is dead on arrival and that this is not a proposal that they can support. So there are leverage points that are out there. On budgeting, it's hard to use the courts, but on rolling back rules like the Clean Power Plan or other important regulations, the courts are available to us. And Donald Trump is not a dictator, as much as he might like to be. He cannot just roll back rules and regulations without going through the proper process. And so if he does go through the proper process, it's clear that climate science is real, greenhouse gases are a problem, and that if the EPA is really going to follow the laws and be protective of human health, it's going to have to take into account and regulate these things. And so as he tries to avoid those obligations, the courts are available to us.
That was Benjamin Schreiber, senior political strategist with Friends of the Earth. Learn more about how environmental groups are responding to President Trump's plan to dismantle the EPA by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the Democratic Party was adjusting to being iced out of power in Congress and the White House under the presidency of Donald Trump, the long-awaited election of a new chair of the Democratic National Committee was held in Atlanta, Georgia, on February 25th. The two main contenders for the post were Democratic Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota, a supporter of Bernie Sanders' presidential bid, and former Obama Labor Secretary Tom Perez. When Perez won the chairmanship by a vote of 235-200, there were concerns that many Sanders supporters and other progressives who had supported Ellison may choose to walk away from the party and invest their time and energy in independent political projects. But Perez, a supporter of Hillary Clinton's failed bid for the White House, immediately offered an olive branch to his opponent and his many union supporters by offering Ellison the post of deputy chair. Despite serious divisions within the party over issues such as the role of superdelegates in the nomination process, a vote that rejected extending the 8-year ban on corporate political action committee donations to the party, and continuing anger at the DNC for tilting toward Hillary in the primary campaign, Ellison joined Perez in calling for unity in opposing Donald Trump and his right-wing agenda. Your reporter spoke with Shannon Jackson, executive director of Our Revolution, a progressive political action group formed by Bernie Sanders supporters after the 2016 primary campaign. Here, Jackson reflects on the victory of Tom Perez over Our Revolution's endorsed candidate Keith Ellison for DNC chair, and the challenges ahead for a party
that has seen historic losses in Congress, governor's races, and state legislative seats.
It's disappointing. We really saw an incredible leader in Keith and thought he embodied exactly what we wanted the Democratic Party to become. We thought he had a transformative organizing energy that would have really brought the values that we feel the majority of the electorate that make up the Democratic Party care about. We felt that Keith was an incredible, is an incredible leader, and he's been an incredible leader both organizing and through his campaigning in Minnesota and on the countless of races that he's been involved with throughout the U.S., including Senator Sanders' run for president. It needs to be stated that we are very disappointed that his run was unsuccessful, but we are hopeful that Secretary Perez, now DNC Chairman Perez, will work with Keith to learn from his skills and supplement his ability to lead the party in that direction. His move to give Representative Ellison the position of deputy chair was, I hope it actually becomes something. Some could be said that was a consolation prize. I would hope that Keith does play a very large role in forming the new Democratic Party and something that our supporters in our revolution want to be a part of. Regardless of the direction the DNC takes, I'm actually very worried where it goes after the vote it took before the DNC chair was elected. There was a vote about accepting large corporations' monies and donations. It was a ban that had been lifted after 8 years of being in place under the Obama administration. It was voted upon by the same members that then elected Perez to reinstate it. That does concern me. It does not show me that they are learning from what works and what doesn't work. Our supporters of our revolution really are concerned with where money comes from, who we answer to. Our revolution is proud to have a full disclosure policy and not take any corporate money, and we would wish that the DNC followed suit that same standards. But I really do encourage people to get involved locally. I think that we were looking at the DNC race in a two-part strategy. We had the how are we going to transform the Democratic Party? We were supporting Keith on top. That was our top-down approach. And then we had the bottom-up approach, which we're still actively engaged with, in which when every state over the next 2 years, as they reorganize their state party for the DNC, there are state party elections and there are precinct races on every level for people to get involved with. I think in total, there's something like 6,800 positions that people can run for locally, be involved on the local level of their Democratic Party and make the Democratic Party something they are proud of.
Shannon, of the many serious issues that the Democratic Party confronts now, where they no longer have control of any branch of the federal government, have lost a majority of governor's seats, and over the past 8 years lost nearly 1,000 legislative seats in state legislatures across the country, what are some of the big issues that you think the party needs to confront internally before they can really tackle the major issues of the all-important message to people around the country as to why Democrats should be trusted with positions of power and decision-making?
That's a great question. I think if you look at the country right now, as you've said, we've lost over 1,000 seats nationwide at local levels. We do not have, I think the Republicans are just a few governorships away from being able to have a constitutional convention, which they could completely rule this country in directions that we would not want to live under. And it's scary. It's disappointing. It's a huge red flag that the Democratic Party has not been receptive or hearing the people's needs and relating to the working class Americans and giving them a reason to vote for them. I think they need to take a hard look at their message and see how they can attract the working class Americans back to their party. They have these listening tours that they showcase as they go around and listen to the people that are actually living in their communities. I think they should be more than just a show of face. I think they should really listen to their constituents. I think they need to understand that the minimum wage and the progressive platform that we crafted after the election is exactly the direction people need to head. The Democrats have a very good social platform. They have all the great talking points of bringing people together, of rallying around the social issues that on a large swath basis you could say the Republicans are very divisive. The Democrats are meant for people to come to them. They should have everyone racing for them, and they should be the ones in power, but they are not. And they have to take a long look at what are the issues that are actually resonating with people. I believe they are the issues of economics and the platform that Senator Sanders ran on. The majority of things the senator spoke about were the issues, and the issues that meant the most to people were what they were viewing in their everyday life, whether it was healthcare, whether it was family leave, whether it was something that affected them today in the workplace, a paycheck. The Democratic Party needs to find those values and run on them and talk to the people.
That was Shannon Jackson, executive director of Our Revolution, a progressive political action group formed by Bernie Sanders supporters after the 2016 primary campaign. Learn more about Our Revolution and find more analysis on the outcome of the election for DNC chair by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Julie Richards is an Oglala Lakota woman who grew up on one of the Sioux reservations that dot North and South Dakota. As a water protector, she was the first woman to lock herself down to oil drilling machinery as Energy Transfer Partners was building the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. The pipeline is heading toward completion as the company, with the blessing of the Trump administration, drills under the Missouri River to complete the more than 1,100-mile project that indigenous people call the Black Snake. Richards was recently on an East Coast tour with members of the Red Warrior Society, talking about the ongoing fight to stop the pipeline. She also spoke about a group she founded years earlier called MAMA, or Mothers Against Meth Alliance. Methamphetamine, also known as crystal meth or simply meth, is a highly addictive stimulant that can be smoked, injected, inhaled, or taken by mouth. Richards was moved to act after her daughter got caught up in meth addiction, a scourge in Native communities in the Dakotas that exploded when so-called man camps were built to bring in oil extraction and pipeline workers. Already plagued by high rates of alcoholism and suicide, people living on reservations in the Northern Plains now face the potentially deadly threat of meth addiction. As part of the tour, Julie Richards gave a talk at the Unitarian Society of Hartford, Connecticut on February 6th. The following excerpts from Richards' nearly hour-long discussion were recorded and produced by Between the Lines Melinda Tuhus.
Do any of you know about the man camps? And yeah, a lot of people don't know about it. So wherever there's oil industry or mining, the workers there are all men. The ones that come in, they're men, especially the pipelines. And they set up camps wherever they're setting the pipelines up. They'll set up camps there. And a lot of them are already into drugs because they need those drugs to stay up all night. When we were at camp, those lights are on all night. They work all night. As you know, I told those cops, they're not staying up all night like that with just coffee. They're on meth. They're doing meth. And they set up so close to the reservations. They usually recruited one Indian man to work for them. And then they use him to recruit the Native women from the tribe. They use him to introduce the tribe to the drugs. And now it's heroin. My tribe still wants him into the meth epidemic, but a lot of other tribes are into the heroin now. That's coming from these man camps. And they mix the heroin with the meth, and that's even more dangerous. And so it's mostly men, and so then they start sex trafficking. They need the women, and if there's not that many women, they turn to the young boys. They'll recruit a young boy to go into their camp to do different odd jobs, and then they end up using him for sex. And that's the type of stuff that our Native women deal with when there's oil industry, is the sex violence, and it's all connected. The oil industry, the pipelines, the man camps, the meth and heroin, the sex trafficking, and it leads to the missing and murdered indigenous women. You know, it's all connected and nobody really knows that. So that was my fight there. That was my fight at Standing Rock. So not only are they desecrating Mother Earth and poisoning our water, our sisters are disappearing. Our daughters are disappearing at a high rate. But the cops prefer to protect the pipeline. Every time I come across, you know, face-to-face fighting with the meth dealer, what they don't know is that it's not just me they're fighting against. That's why they can't harm me. My ancestors are surrounding me. At Sundance, my ancestors fought to be with me in this fight against meth and to keep me safe, and they have. There's so many times I could have been killed, but my ancestors saved me. I started going into the jail. The jail contacted me and asked me if I'd go in and do meth awareness and education with the men and women in jail. So I did. So my very first one was with the women. The second one was with the men, and it was all the meth dealers that I had been fighting with that, you know, had threatened to kill me. I probably threatened to kill them too, you know. But I came face to face with them, and I started telling them, you know, my perspective on it, coming from a mother's perspective on it. From seeing my daughter so high that she was freaking out and seeing things. My ancestors are stronger than you, you mess, period. You know, you got me, you know, because it doesn't and it never will. You know, it tries to attack me in different ways than people. You know, at first I thought I was going crazy because I'd be ready to go out and do a meth awareness or a walk and rally, and I'd have my phone on the charger all night, and I'd get to the place where we're going to walk and my phone will be dead. I will get done with the presentation and my car will be dead. One time we went to another reservation and did a walk and rally there. That was the first one that they ever had. And when we were ready to leave, all four of our cars were dead. And the people there were like, gee, wow, did you guys only be radio on? I was like, no, that's just that, you know, that's that mess spirit. So that's why I'm always smudging. We smudge down before we come in here, but you know, when I'm done talking about it or whatever, I smudge down again because, you know, it thinks I'm giving it attention, but I'm not. You know, I'm still fighting against it because I'm bringing that awareness about it. And I'll keep fighting until the day I die. I'll keep fighting against this drug because I see the devastation. I see my beautiful daughter turn into somebody that she wasn't. I'd sit up with her for days. I'd be tired, I'd doze off, but I'd get up with her because I didn't want her to be up by herself because she became suicidal. And that suicide is another evil spirit that goes hand in hand with it, along with alcohol. Alcohol is also one of my fights now. I fight against that liquid genocide. I fight against meth, I fight for the water, I fight for the land. You know, I refuse to be a victim of boarding school trauma. I refuse to be a victim of sexual assault. Child sexual abuse. I refuse to be a victim of false abuse. I refuse to be a victim of alcohol abuse, and I refuse to be a victim of drug abuse. I'm a survivor. I'm a warrior.
That was Julie Richards, founder of the group Mothers Against Meth Alliance. Learn more about groups combating meth addiction in Indigenous communities by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
On death row, with no death sentence. For several years now, well over a decade, the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections kept dozens of men on death row, even though they didn't have a pending death sentence. These men, held at the state's death rows in Greene County and Greaterford, were people who had their death sentences overturned by a state or federal court and held in solitary confinement for months and years until two men filed suits against this long-standing DOC practice. Craig Williams of Greene and Sean T. Walker of Greaterford filed separate civil actions in federal court challenging this procedure, but both men initially lost. Both men began their actions by filing their suits pro se or without a lawyer, and both filed appeals before the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, where both men prevailed. The Federal Appeals Court ruled in a February 9, 2007 opinion that the continued detention of men in solitary confinement who had no pending death sentences was violative of a state-created liberty interest under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Williams spent 6 years on death row without a death sentence. Walker spent 8 years on death row without a death sentence. In Williams versus Secretary, DOC, the Third Circuit found this confinement unconstitutional, but also granted the DOC the defense that, until now, this right wasn't clearly established. The Williams decision, being the first of its kind, put the DOC on notice that such a practice was now per se unconstitutional and a violation of a prisoner's state-created liberty interest. Williams proved a talented jailhouse lawyer when he was on the row. He's been off death row since 2012, and he's still one hell of a jailhouse lawyer, still making new law. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Water is life. From Flint to Standing Rock to the Pennsylvania prison system. Since August 2016 to the present, Mumia Abu-Jamal and other inmates at SCI Mahanoy in Pennsylvania have been plagued with unsafe drinking and bathing water. Inmates have complained about hazardous brown water for several months, and prison officials have done nothing to fix the problem. Enough is enough. We are calling for the general public to call Department of Corrections Secretary John Wetzel at 717-728-4109 and demand inmates are given access to clean water for showering and personal use. For more info, people can go to www.freemomia.com.
Under the system of capitalism, we've experienced a proliferation of homelessness. You would think that the growing number of homeless people would impeach the mythology promoted by the United States that this is the land of opportunity. You would think. Instead, what we typically find is that the belief regarding homelessness is that they are shiftless and lazy or perhaps mentally ill. Most Americans hold on to the idea that homeless people are somehow qualitatively different from us, that they possess some kind of malfunction that makes them that way. On occasion, you might find an ordinary, hard-working American who experiences a streak of misfortune, and he or she might end up homeless temporarily before invariably pulling herself or himself up by the bootstraps. We Americans are bootstrap pullers. We don't stay down long. So the long-term homeless, those are the folks who have something wrong with them. This popular conception is reinforced even in entertainment. Consider the acclaimed film, The Pursuit of Happiness, where Will Smith portrays an industrious and self-motivated man who finds himself homeless along with his young son due to no fault of his own. We see Will Smith's character struggling to find work, bathing in public bathroom sinks, and waiting in line at homeless shelters. In the end, our motivated and hardworking hero finds a gravy white-collar job and achieves the American dream, just like we always knew he would. We can feel good. We can vicariously live out his redemption story. We don't think about the other 200 homeless people who were waiting in line at the shelter, or how those 200 people were there the day after Will Smith's character got hired, or the day after that. Those aren't the stories that interest Hollywood or us. Deep down, we know if those people weren't somehow malfunctioned, and if they just had Will Smith's assertiveness, they could grab hold of their bootstraps. So we don't think about them. I heard a statistic recently on the average age of a homeless person in the United States. Know what it is? 9 years old. To reconcile this fact with our popular beliefs, we must conclude that in the United States, we have an inordinate number of lazy, shiftless, mentally ill 9-year-olds. If only those wayward 9-year-olds would straighten up, fly right, get haircuts and jobs, they could pull themselves up by the bootstraps. 9-year-olds these days, they act like they're entitled. So here's my thinking. We have a totally obsolete view of homelessness. Right now, as civilization unravels, we see a groundswell of those who are alienated and displaced, mostly vulnerable populations like the very young or the mentally ill or the aged. This is a growing population that isn't served by the larger system, a population from which the larger system doesn't seem to feel it can gain any service either. So these are people whose civilization is essentially divorcing. There's a kind of termination of the standard relationship. As civilized people, indoctrinated on the mythology, we fear such a situation, viewing homelessness as precarious and vulnerable and helpless. I'm not sure that's altogether accurate. I'm reminded of Henry David Thoreau, a famous dead guy, who analyzed our civilized way of life in a comparison to Native American tribes. Thoreau questioned the wisdom of toiling and struggling for 30 years in order to pay off a house when Native Americans could build their respective shelters in a matter of hours. He concluded that we don't so much as own our homes as our homes own us. So in that light, we should probably think of the homeless not as vulnerable and helpless, but as free. The tribes of teenagers who squat in the tunnels of the New York subway system are not shackled by 30 years of servitude to pay off their living spaces. Because we've been programmed to think of being anchored to one spot, indoctrinated to equate sedentary existence with security, we are unable to perceive that the people we call homeless are not without places to live. What I mean is, they aren't living nowhere, they're living everywhere. While all of us chained in place think of our living spaces as constituted by a specific set of four walls, homeless people are at home wherever they are. It would seem that this is a sentiment that's contagious. In 2009, for instance, 1 million homeowners in the U.S. simply walked away from their homes and opted for homelessness. The fact of the matter is, civilization is in decay. It is falling to pieces. It's unsustainable, unsalvageable, and at some point, according to some sort of pecking order,
that's going to spit all of us out. It's inevitable. It occurs to me that when this monster machine finally crumbles in its own footprint, those of us with the greatest chance of making the post-civilization transition are those with the experience of traveling light, of foraging creatively, of surviving successfully in mobile communities. Homelessness is the wave of the future. Let's all walk away right now and get a head start. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional, Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Does the Trump presidency pose to elite corporate elements within the United States? What are the real reasons Trump's cabinet picks are under scrutiny for their past conversations with Russian officials? Should Canadians be heartened or concerned by the Trudeau government's cordial engagement with the newly elected president last month? What is the mainstream media failing to adequately convey in its news coverage of the Trump administration's reporting on this week's speech to Congress? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we continue examining the Trump presidency and the ways in which elite authorities are positioning themselves to confront the Trump administration 6 weeks after the president's inauguration and days after his first speech to Congress. We'll speak with outspoken author, analyst, and retired Binghamton University Emeritus Professor James Petras. We'll hear from Vancouver-based writer and newcoldwar.org editor Roger Annis. And we'll hear from Toronto-based media analyst Barry Zwicker. On this week's program, Trump and the Deep State, Part 3, Investigating Russia, Détente with Canada, and the Speech to Congress. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 3rd, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. His Tuesday address was long on making America safe for Wall Street, war profiteers, and other corporate predators, short on what's most needed to serve all Americans equitably and promote world peace. He focused on increased military spending at a time major cuts are needed, combating terrorism without explaining ISIS and like-minded groups are U.S. creations used as imperial foot soldiers. He called for repealing and replacing Obamacare, omitting what he and GOP lawmakers want is something worse, maybe devastating for the nation's most vulnerable. "We will soon begin the construction of a great wall along our southern border," he said. He lied, claiming it'll deter illicit drugs and crime. That comes from the article, "Trump's Address to the U.S. Congress, Making America Safe for Wall Street and War Profiteers," by Stephen Lentman, posted March 2nd. This was reality television made flesh, the grandest show. Congress turned into more than a mere Will Rogers comedy set. It was a show topped by the grieving widow, Karen Owens, wife of Chief Petty Officer William Ryan Owens, a Navy SEAL who fell in Trump's authorized raid in Yemen. Quote, "Ryan died as he lived, a warrior and a hero, battling against terrorism and securing our nation," unquote. Mythology and the military-industrial complex as one. Illusions united. That comes from the article, "Trump's Joint Address, The Reality Show Comes to U.S. Congress," by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted March 2nd. There is no point taking piecemeal measures or organizing one-off events, no matter how big, to express your concern. If you don't plan, organize, and act strategically, you will have wasted your time and effort on something that has no impact. Remember the 15th of February 2003? Up to 30 million people in over 600 cities around the world participated in rallies against the war on Iraq in what some labeled the largest protest event in human history. Did it stop the war? That comes from the article, "Resisting Donald Trump's Violence Strategically," by Robert J. Burroughs, posted March 2nd. Syrian-American Sarah Abed was born in Al-Kamishli and has lived in both the USA and Syria throughout her life. She makes frequent trips back and forth. Sarah is in direct daily contact with family and friends that reside in different parts of Syria. Sarah conducted and translated an interview with a close friend, Samir, who lives in Syria and is well informed about the conditions on the ground. Samir's commentaries are consistent with President Assad's assessment of the imperialists' strategy of divide and conquer. That comes from the article, "Syria, the Criminal Empire's Strategy of Divide, Conquer, and Destroy," part one of a series by Mark Taliano and Sarah Abed, posted March 2nd. The White Helmets continues to play a leading role in the Western cyber warfare as a weapon which is used against the legitimate government of Syria. Due to a great number of fake photos and videos in the social networks, picturing rescuers who risk their lives to save civilians caught in the country's devastating war, the Western audience receives a distorted picture of the military situation in Syria. Western TV channels, including Pan-Arabic Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, promote White Helmets as the only humanitarian organization which is allegedly engaged in rescuing Syrians. At the same time, in their coverage, they have never mentioned the actual efforts of the Syrian government and its allies for the sake of settlement of the crisis and supplying the affected population with humanitarian aid. It seems that the winner of the best documentary short was decided long before the ceremony, with powerful figures with a finger in a pie of the jury's final decision. That comes from the article, The Deception Technology, Hollywood Oscar for Fake Movie, by Firas Samouri, posted March 2nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Six weeks have elapsed since the inauguration of Donald Trump, and the assault on his administration seems to continue unabated. The biggest hit on Trump's presidency remains the allegation that Russian government sources are interfering with the integrity of U.S. democracy. In December, the FBI officially accused Russia of interfering in the U.S. election in order to assist the Republican candidate. This on the same day outgoing President Obama accused the Russian president of knowing about the hacks. 2 weeks later, the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI released a joint report detailing Russian hacking of the DNC's computer network, resulting in Washington announcing a new round of sanctions against Russia and the expulsion of 35 Russian diplomats. In mid-January, a CIA dossier emerged containing salacious and unverified information that Trump had been cavorting with prostitutes in a Moscow hotel room and that Russian intelligence had filmed the encounter, making the billionaire susceptible to blackmail at a later date. Then in mid-February, Trump's pick for National Security Advisor Michael Flynn resigned in the wake of suggestions he had supposedly misled Vice President Pence on the extent of his communications with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak. Now, on March 2nd, the day before this episode goes to air, Trump's Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, announced that he will recuse himself from any investigations into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. This on the grounds that he had not disclosed to Congress two meetings last year with the Russian ambassador. In tandem with officialdom's questioning of Trump's fitness to govern, popular mobilizations, mostly focused on Trump's hostility towards Muslims, migrants, and women, have dogged him since Inauguration Day. Joining us to discuss the Trump presidency and the apparent effort to attack his foreign policy, if not remove him from the Oval Office, is James Petras. James Petras is a retired Bartle Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York, and is also a adjunct professor at St. Mary's University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Petras.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Okay, now, I know that there are a lot of legitimate grievances that many Americans and people around the world have toward the Trump administration, but there does seem to be a serious effort to destabilize his presidency, if not remove him entirely. And I find myself, I'm reminded a little bit of the lead up to the war in Iraq, where they seem to be going from one pretext to another, you know, links with 9/11 and human rights violations and so on, until eventually settling on the narrative of weapons of mass destruction. And right now, what I'm looking with the efforts, apparent efforts to destabilize the Trump presidency from higher up elements, I mean, they seem to be looking at Islamophobia and misogyny and whatnot, but it seems like the one that seems to be sticking and doubling down on is this effort to link him with, you know, as being some sort of a Russian agent, and that there's some sort of
some kind of duplicity there. And so we've seen General Flynn has been removed because of his conversations, as well as now just today we're hearing about Jeff Sessions and his communications that seem to be, you know, being said, we're seeing him being set up for some sort of a fall. So I'm wondering what you are reading into this this Russia narrative is somehow the cudgel that's being used to beat Trump.
I think the main thing to look at here is the introduction by Trump in as a new kind of imperialism, and his original strategy was essentially to eschew military types of intervention, wars, and attempts to encircle Russia and ultimately destroy it. I think the Obama administration and its predecessors were intent on reverting Russia back into the 1990s to the 2000 mark, overthrow Putin and establish a kind of unilateral power of the United States over the world economy, world military. And insofar as Trump was pursuing a policy which looked toward reconciliation and developing favorable trade terms with Russia as part of a general strategy of improving U.S. exports on a world scale, cutting back on imports and renegotiating with China its trade agreements, and the Trans-Pacific he dumped because he thought this was further undermining the U.S. export position and was becoming essentially an importing comprador kind of capitalism. And so the fact that Trump made some gestures which were completely harmless of discussing with the Russian ambassador before the inauguration is a phony pretext. It was essentially to knock out one of Trump's key operatives in this new paradigm that I mentioned of promoting market imperialism as opposed to military imperialism. I think that's the key to the whole strategy. And essentially, it's a strategy first undermining Trump's promoter, Flynn, and continuing on purging whatever officials are in the Trump administration, in his cabinet, and eventually overthrowing Trump through some phony charges once they've disarmed and disarticulated his program. Hmm. Trump wants a market relationship. He wants to increase U.S. Competitiveness. He wants to increase the power of the working class in order to have a kind of social imperialism, strong at home in order to dominate overseas markets. He's not interested. He wasn't interested primarily in military occupations, particularly of countries that he thought either the U.S. could dominate economically or were not significant to his general overview. So I think to answer on the short run your immediate question, yes, they want to overthrow Trump because they're opposed to his imperial strategy. This is very serious business because it's a division between two sets of oligarchies. The market oligarchy, the exporters, the working class, the attempts to further U.S. investments and return the profits back into the United States, as opposed to previous administrations, the Democrats, the liberals, the neoliberals, the neocons, their policy essentially is driven by a military imperialism that seeks to dominate and occupy countries of existence. And they've totally failed. Their military ventures are leading to prolonged wars. Their budgets were totally out of whack. $1 trillion trade deficits between the Asian countries and the United States, of which Taiwan, Singapore, and South Korea are a percentage of the GNP that comes from U.S. exports far exceeds China. So this is a historical problem and an attempt by Trump to rectify this damaging approach to imperialism and undermining through low wages the social underpinnings for economic imperialism.
I've got a question, because you had a previous article. You alluded to these efforts against Trump as a CIA regime change operation coming home.
Well, it's not just the CIA. The state apparatus that Trump inherited, one of his strategic errors, was not taking on and changing the structures of this the permanent state apparatus, what some people call the state silent state apparatus. But I think that's part of it. It's also the mass media. It's also the ideologues. It's also the importers. Especially the large commercial places that depend on cheap imports and cheap labor. And these were the forces that are allied against Trump, not to speak of the entire Democratic Party, especially its liberal and neocon versions. And I think this is what is at stake. We have rival imperial oligarchs fighting it out. And I think so far Trump has been losing as they peel away his supporters. And Sessions is even more preposterous. As a head of the Armed Services Committee, he had every right to open a dialogue with Russian diplomatic people. He spoke to 25 deputy ambassadors and foreign Russian foreign policy, among others, but 25 officials of state, foreign state, suddenly out of the hat, they pick his meetings with the Russians. This is a phony as a $3 bill.
But at the same time, I mean, there are some things that that Mr. Trump is proposing that does seem to be favorable, at least to within the Republican Party. You know, the tax cuts and the fewer regulations.
Yes, that's
less,
true.
And the whole,
we're going to get ultimately, short of the overthrow of Trump, is the worst features of the neocon Democrats and the worst features of Trump's pro-business position. We're going to get the war policies abroad and the tax cuts domestically, which means lower living standards, because Trump will not have the opportunity of imposing market capitalism, which could possibly increase the flow of profits and investments back into the United States.
Well, just going back to, you know, the kind of the parallels with regime change operations in Latin America and abroad, I think there's always been some sense where you might have certain leaders that might be given a bit of a leeway, given a chance, but eventually they say, this isn't going to work. You know, whether it was, you know, Aristide or Chavez or whoever, and they make the decision to pull the plug. Is it possible that Trump might be allowed to retain his office as long as he changes tack on some of
Well, that's what they're doing now. It's incremental coupism, if you want. It's first strip him of power, undermine his program and then create conditions that make him extremely vulnerable. He'll lose his support among workers. His inability to implement an effective growth policy is going to cause a stock crash. He'll be very vulnerable to being ousted.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and we, of course, we have like the Vice President Mike Pence and Mad Dog Mattis, as he's called, and these other figures in the administration. I mean, should Trump be removed, it would seem that you're not going to have any resistance to that that neocon design.
Well, I don't. I mean, Pence may come to power, but he'll be simply a tool of the power structure that replaces Trump.
Mm-hmm. But so essentially, just getting rid of the whatever assistance. So that, like you.
Trump has had a strategy. Trump had a paradigm for revising and upgrading U.S. imperialism around a totally different direction than what preceded it. He wasn't engaged in a worldwide effort to realign U.S. against Russia. He didn't have a strategy of militarily encircling China. What he wanted by throwing out the Trans-Pacific was to begin bilateral negotiations to get better economic terms. Obama was trying to provoke wars in the South Pacific. He was setting up bases. He was sacrificing U.S. trade advantages in order to build up allies to attack China. Trump is not into that. He's into renegotiating trade terms with China and the rest of Asia and using whatever muscle he has militarily to leverage that renegotiations.
Now, there are mobilizations, popular mobilizations against Trump, and I'm sure you would agree that the most of those people who are mobilizing in the streets and so on are not necessarily on the same page as the these elite figures that are seeking to overthrow
the
team.
Well, a lot of them are being used. Don't forget, George Soros is financing a lot of these NGOs. You get a lot of people that are somehow employed in one form or another in the public sector, which is facing cuts as part of Trump's pro-capitalist policies. You have feminist movements that represent particularly middle-class, lower-middle-class, and upper-class women who are not facing the economic pressure opportunities that Trump outlines, but face, in fact, some threats. And, of course, the symbolism of Trump's attitude that has been magnified by the media, some of his talks about sexual policies toward women, the sexual harassment, et cetera, things that happened 10 and 20 years ago. Again, this is magna politics, magnifying the past in order to maximize political advantage in the short run. There are many people at protest that should have protested against Obama. Don't forget, Obama expelled 2.5 million immigrants, breaking down doors, seizing people from factories, etc. And these people that are protesting never raised a finger against the forced seizure and expulsion of 2.5 million Latinos and Central Americans and others.
Well, what do you say to this argument that, be that as it may, those elite factions the fact is that you have a Republican in power now, and like the anti-war movement and all these social justice movements, which seem to be asleep under Obama, maybe now they could in some sense align themselves with these deep state elements, you know, like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Is there a danger in that?
Absolutely a danger, because the Democrats are going to squeeze, and then they're going to toss him like a used condom. There's no history of Obama fighting for higher wages. There's no history of Obama fighting for even a simple issue like easing the vote for unionization. There were many assassinations and abuse of blacks during Obama's presidency, the difference between black workers and white workers increased, the inequalities increased during Obama, the $1 trillion subsidies for the big bailouts of the banks far exceeded the 2.5 million mortgage holders who lost their home. I mean, this was a totally reactionary regime in every sense of the word, from seven wars to pro-banker, pro-war policies. And I think we have to put that in perspective. And the challenge that Trump represented by his turn toward market imperialism was a very profound a challenge to that whole operations, and I think that's why they're going for the throat.
Just one last question, and I'll let you go. Is there an opportunity for the working class and all these other marginalized peoples to benefit from this situation that doesn't necessarily advance the prospects either of Trump or the neocons and
I think the overthrow of Trump will deepen the reaction, deepen the alienation of workers to Washington. I think the possibilities of greater militancy would have to wait until a new leadership emerges. As it is, the bulk of the trade union bureaucracy is totally aligned with the Democrats, who are in turn in bed with Wall Street and military imperialism. I think there is virtually no possibility of an alternative to the Democrats on the horizon now. And I think I'm afraid that this period of overthrowing or decimating Trump is simply going to make things worse and undermine whatever trade union access they had to power.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us and sharing
your
thoughts.
Okay, very good.
With us.
Thanks for inviting me.
We've been speaking with Professor James Petras. He's retired Bartle Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York. He's also a widely sought commentator and a regular contributor to the Global Research website. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Canada's federal government has had to adjust to the reality of the new Trump administration. So far, the leaders of the two neighboring countries appeared at ease and even friendly with each other when they met in Washington, D.C. in mid-February. However, appearances can sometimes be deceiving. The Trudeau government is vocally supportive of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which the U.S. president has vowed to renegotiate. Trump's rhetoric against migrants from Mexico and Muslims runs afoul of Canada's advocacy for openness on the world stage. Trump's past misogynistic behavior sparked demonstrations on the day after his inauguration, as opposed to the feminist background of the Trudeau. And what's more, Trump himself has consistently argued for more congenial relations with the Russian government, while his predecessor and rivals for the presidency. Much of the Western press and even Canadian officials have consistently expressed hostility to perceived Russian aggression in Crimea and elsewhere, warranting sanctions and military mobilizations. To discuss what the Trump presidency means for Canadian foreign policy, we're joined by another past guest. Roger Annis is a socialist, a trade union activist, and a retired aerospace worker based in Vancouver. He writes regularly on topics of war and social justice and is an editor and regular contributor to newcoldwar.org. Welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour, Roger.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good to be with you.
Roger, you wrote an article declaring that corporate Canada breathed a sigh of relief following Trudeau's visit to Washington, suggesting that maintaining Canada's business relationship with the U.S. was being given a higher priority than the progressive social and environmental priorities of most Canadians. Are there any concrete concessions that Trudeau has made in the interests of kowtowing to business elites in both countries?
Well, I think there is. Really, the Canadian government and other governments in the world that claim or pretend to be liberal are a little bit off balance by the election of Trump in the United States. It's clearly a departure from their way of looking at the world and governing the world, as a departure from the Obama administration that preceded it. But if you look at the outcome of the Trudeau visit to Washington in mid-February, and also when you start to look at the specific policy issues, and I'm thinking particularly as concerns foreign policy and also as concerns North American energy, or shall we say resource plunder policy, there's a terrific synchronism there. And so I think it's no accident that the Canadian government and the Canadian business elite finished the Trudeau's visit to Washington with what I said was a sigh of relief. It went well, and Trump himself went out of his way to declare that Canada is, if not the closest ally of the United States, then one of the closest allies. And of course, that's true and been very true for decades. So they are unsettled because there's uncertainty about all this, in the same way that many of the business elite in the United States are settled, rather unsettled. But are we going to see, deep friction between the two governments, deep divergences in policy? Frankly, I don't think so. We already see a lot of similarity, and I think to the extent that there's disagreement, for example, the stated positions on immigration, I think we're going to see the Canadian government simply adapt itself to the U.S. government. And indeed, in today's Globe and Mail is an article by Reuters explaining that there are extensive talks going on right now between the U.S. and government, U.S. and Canadian governments, to bring Canadian immigration policy into line with this outrageous conduct by the new U.S. government under Trump.
It's quite amazing. I think it's also noteworthy about the role of U.S. border guards now. And there's some incoming legislation in Canada that would allow U.S. border guards to detain Canadians traveling to the country and prevent them from coming into the country, and even interrogate them rather aggressively.
Oh, it's incredible, this law that the Minister of National Security Goodale is proposing, ceding national sovereignty to American customs agents, giving them the power to detain and even strip search Canadians on Canadian soil. I mean, what could perhaps illustrate better in pretty graphic terms how far this Canadian government is preparing to go to accommodate itself to the U.S. government?
There was a major cabinet shuffle in Ottawa on the eve of Trump's inauguration. Notably, the shuffle saw Ukrainian, Canadian, and a relative newcomer, Chrystia Freeland. She was also a former trade minister, replacing Stéphane Dion, who was a long-serving Liberal cabinet minister, as the new foreign affairs minister, a very prestigious post. I was wondering if you see that move as connected in any way with the incoming Trump presidency, and what direction this might take Canada's foreign policy.
You know, that move was and remains a bit of a mystery. I think what's simply involved is you have a combination of Chrystia Freeland's own personal ambitions to rise up the corporate and political ladder, clashing with Stéphane Dion, the ousted foreign minister. I think that's the main thing that's taken place. For however this was done, she convinced Trudeau in the inner circle that she would be better placed as a foreign minister. I know, of course, there was speculation about perhaps some friction or disagreement with respect to policy to Russia, because Dion, in the year and a couple of months that he was foreign minister, he was speaking out of both sides of his mouth on the issue of relations with Russia. That is, he said, on the one hand, you know, we have to maintain a certain level of dialogue and even cooperation with Russia. And he cited specifically Arctic cooperation, which is actually a no-brainer. I mean, are the countries of the Arctic going to stop cooperating with it? I mean, that's just not going to work on any level. But he did voice that. And then he kind of, you know, he just voiced a few reservations about the calls from the extreme right in the Ukrainian diaspora here. There should be no relations with Russia, and, you know, everything should go from bad to worse. So, you know, that was Dion's pronouncement. But on the other side of his mouth, Dion was continuing with Canada's military participation in the intervention in Ukraine, the ongoing sanctions against Russia and Crimea. In fact, Dion brought in some additional sanctions measures compared to the Harper regime before him. So I don't think there was a I don't think that this was a substantive issue. That is, I don't think that the extreme right in Canada, with whom Freeland herself is very closely associated, saw Dion as kind of an unreliable foreign minister and so on. I think that was maybe a small part of it, but I think the bigger story there is one that we don't know and didn't have a lot to do with Canada-Russia relations. That's my best guess, and it's only one observer's best guess.
Okay, that's fair enough. But, I mean, you talked about perhaps a less hostile approach on the part of Dion towards Russia. And, I mean, this seems to be the big hit on Trump. I mean, I'm just saying that, like, is there any solace? I mean, for all of the legitimate grievances people have about Trump, is there any solace in the fact that he has called for better relations with Russia versus the more confrontational rhetoric we've heard from Democrats like Obama and Clinton?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a really important question and a really important issue to think about, because I have been a bit of a lone wolf on this, if I could say, from the get-go. I never believed for a moment that under Donald Trump we would see a different policy that towards Russia and the rest of the world, that is, a less aggressive policy. I just didn't believe it. And I also, I looked and read closely at Trump, what Trump himself was saying. And, you know, it was a few off-the-cuff remarks. People said, what's your attitude to Russia? He said, well, you know, why don't we get along? What's wrong with that? These sorts of things. Well, I mean, all that has been, I think, put to rest, certainly as of the speech to Congress a couple of days ago. But, you know, and I think it was there before, but it's certainly been put to rest now. Trump is, you know, just declaring that the U.S. will embark on the biggest military buildup in its history, including a further buildup of its nuclear arsenal. Trump, you know, reports or Trump claims that the U.S. has lost some of its nuclear hegemony compared to Russia in past years and decades, which I don't think is true. But in any event, it was actually the Obama administration that began a multi-billion, I think it's even $1 trillion renewal or upgrading, if you could say, horrible term to think about, of the nuclear arsenal. And, you know, Trump has not only endorsed that, but he's sort of gone further in sort of stepping up the rhetoric on a new nuclear arms race with Russia. So, I mean, that's the substantive Trump. The few phrases that were tossed out here and there during the election campaign and even after his election, to me, never counted for very much. What counts is what the declared purpose of the Trump regime's use of the U.S. military is, and it's just, you know, there's little doubt left. And in fact, most of the observers who have kind of, you know, accepted the idea that maybe with Trump we were going to see a less aggressive foreign policy are conceding the point that actually we're headed quite possibly to something worse. well, I don't want to say worse, because what could be worse than the Democrats? But, you know, we're headed towards something equally bad as to what we would have seen with Hillary Clinton as president. I felt this all along, and I feel it even more so today. And so, again, this is where we come back to the issue of Canada. Because if on two key issues, foreign policy and resource extraction, the governments of the United States and Canada are exactly in lockstep with one another. And this is not a question of Canada sort of being pressured to do this. They see eye to eye on foreign policy in Ukraine, in Syria. Well, Canada is not so involved in Asia with the threats against China. But, you know, you just see such a clear commonality of purpose in the foreign policies of the two governments. And so, you know, I think for Canadians, that should be a huge warning sign to kind of open our eyes as to what we have in power in Ottawa. This is a right-wing government in Ottawa that's prepared to coexist with the Trump administration, and in fact already coexists on key policy issues.
You just published an article on newcoldwar.org, which reported on the decision by the Swedish government to reinvoke conscription, citing the Russian threat, as they call it. This seems to be a further illustration that the Russian threat narrative is not only reshaping U.S. politics, but politics in other countries as well. How do you see the new Cold War rhetoric reshaping Canada, and who benefits from that reshaping?
Well, the military-industrial complex benefits this heightened conflict with Russia, although it's not a simple matter of people making money off selling arms. This is a long-standing policy of the United States and the NATO military alliance to weaken, if not divide and conquer, the Soviet Union, then become the Russian Federation. This is why I think the view that, you know, Trump was going to bring about a change in this policy just didn't match up. You know, the U.S. government is not going to overthrow 70 years of anti-Russia, anti-Soviet policy because somebody gets elected and thinks maybe that's a good idea to change the policy. This is such a deeply rooted policy, which isn't just about the military-industrial complex making money off selling arms. It's about them controlling the world. And in today's world, countries that are truly independent, which include Russia, which include China, which I think now you could say includes Iran, Syria. This is a very troubling development for not just the United States, but its allies. Mm-hmm. And this is what they're determined to stamp out. I think this is why we've seen the escalation of the rhetoric and the buildup, the sanctions against Russia since the conflict in Ukraine 3 years ago, because they fear that they're losing this tight control that they had over the world. They fear rising powers, good or bad, of Russia, China, and others. And then, you know, getting to your question about Sweden, well, you know, boy, here's a lesson for Canadians. Here's a country like Canada, that is Sweden, like Canada, has a reputation as a less aggressive power, as a kind of peace-friendly country. I mean, Sweden has much stronger credentials on that score than Canada ever did. And yet, look what's happening in Sweden, introducing military conscription and then just putting the country into a panic stage. I mean, you have to read the Swedish press. I don't read Swedish, but you read the English language press that's published in Sweden. You know, you'd think Russia's going to invade Sweden tomorrow. This is the atmosphere that they're creating. And I think this is a very deliberate part of the conscription policy. Maybe they need conscription, as the Swedish government leaders are saying, in order to keep their military kind of at a higher level of personnel and so forth, of capacity. But I think there's a very big propaganda kind of initiative happening here, which is the Swedish government wants to scare its population, and it wants to scare all the people of the world that look to Sweden as a kind of a peace-loving country into believing that there is an immediate Russian threat against Sweden and against anybody else potentially in the world. This is what this conscription decision is about, and I think it bears a lot of study, in particular by Canadians, because we have so much similarity in the international image of the governments of Canada and Sweden. And clearly in neither country do we have governments that have any interest in peace. And there's simply no – I mean, this has already been argument – you know, without argument the case in Canada, but now even in Sweden, even in so-called peace-loving Sweden, we see, you know, aggressive. And I should even note that this, the government that's undertaken this decision in Sweden is a soft left government. It's a coalition government of the Social Democratic Party and the Green Party, if you can believe it. So this is a bad omen, very bad omen. And, you know, the moment I saw the news this morning, I said, oh, my God, people have to know about this. And I hope that people will indeed look at this decision by Sweden very closely and really think through, you know, what this means in the current context and dynamic of the new Cold War.
Well, on that rather somber note, I do want to thank you, Roger Ennis, for coming on the show and taking the time to share your views with us. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We've been speaking with writer, socialist, and trade union activist Roger Ennis. He is an editor and frequent contributor to the independent news site newcoldwar.org. Some of his articles can also be found on the site rogerannis.com. Some observers believe, especially in the wake of President Trump's speech to Congress, that the press is beginning to normalize Trump, even in the face of a disturbing trajectory his presidency has taken since Inauguration Day. One of those observers is Barry Zwicker. Barry is a Toronto-based media critic with decades of experience as a print and broadcast journalist. He returns to the Global Research NewsHour with some of his thoughts. Good to hear from you again, Barry.
Well, good to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Michael.
I'm going to read to you a quote from Obama partisan and Trump critic Van Jones in reference to Trump's speech before Congress, particularly referencing a salute to the bravery of an American Navy SEAL killed during a recent raid in Yemen. Van Jones said, and I quote, "For people who have been hoping that maybe he would remain a divisive cartoon, which he often finds a way to do, they should begin to become a little bit worried tonight, because that thing you just saw him do, if he finds a way to do that over and over again, he's going to be there for 8 years. Now, there was a lot that he said in that speech that was counterfactual, that was not right, that I oppose and will oppose. But he did something tonight that you cannot take away from him. He became President of the United States," unquote. The sentiment seemed to echo throughout the mainstream media. You saw the president's speech in its entirety. What did you take away from it?
One thing that we have to realize is that we don't have time, you and I, in this brief conversation this morning, to really go as long and deep and wide in any critique of the mainstream media's coverage of Trumpism that we really should do. But in respect of that speech in the Congress and the introduction of the Special Forces widow, I noticed that too when my wife and I were watching. And I've been looking at a little bit of the media coverage since Tuesday's address, too. And maybe these specifics that I intend to bring up would reflect that larger picture that would be for listeners to decide. Now, first, the speech. I found it just painful to watch the Republican lawmakers' reaction to introducing that widow of the U.S. Chief Special Warfare Operator. You know, that's his job description, which means killer in Yemen. And let's be frank, he was a killer. He went to kill, but he got killed. But the Republican-trained SEALs wore out their flippers in a ridiculously drawn-out two-minute paroxysm of self-righteous uber-patriotism. I mean, I'd seen these speeches before, but this had to be the lowest point I'd ever seen. You know, you really get tired of seeing those Republicans especially standing up and applauding. But I saw nothing of this sickeningly memorable moment in the coverage following. That I saw, anyway, the Van Jones quote was new to me. And I'm talking specifically about the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, and CBC Television News and Current Affairs, which I follow all three really closely. I saw nothing about that moment in those three media outlets. And it reminded me again of the incredible power of omission. which is arguably the most potent aspect of political speeches and of media coverage of anything. And now here's what Trump did not address last Tuesday. Not a word about Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. Not a word about the huge gap between the very rich and everyone else, which is the worst since 1920. Not a word about corruption of campaign finance rules, which have been painfully obvious to millions of us and has been for years. Not a word about voter suppression. Not a word about climate change. Not a word about how to fix the broken criminal justice system in the USA, which holds more people in prison than any other country on earth. Not a word about the high cost or the lowering of tuition fees for college and university students. Not a word about the U.S. Treasury losing $100 million a year because of offshore tax havens. Not a word about the cost of prescription drugs. Now, that's just a partial list of what was left out of that speech. Now, here's an interesting, closely related thing. Bernie Sanders, immediately following Trump's speech, took to YouTube and made a brilliant critique of it. The full video runs about 14 minutes, and I viewed that. I found it. Got 2 million plus views. And in it, Sanders focuses on the omissions I've just mentioned. Now, there are five YouTube versions of what he said, one of which is an AP clip that runs a minute 40. Now, how much and how well did the mainstream report Sanders' critique? And it was brilliant, substantial, coherent, and well-expressed. I searched the Globe, print and online. Bernie Sanders' name has not been mentioned in the Globe since February 26th. Not a word. On the CBC, my wife and I did not see an instant of Sanders while we were viewing. I admit I may have missed a clip of him, if such was used, but I can find nothing on the CBC website by searching under the headings radio, TV, news, opinion, or politics. In the Star, nothing in print. But interestingly, on the Star's website is that AP 140 clip. But the sound will not work for me, no matter what I try. This is unusual. What can I say? So the mainstream media failed regarding the significant comments of Bernie Sanders about this speech, even failed in the hoariest bare requirement of doing he said, she said. But there's a plus side. Okay, I'm getting really negative here. On the plus side are two examples from the coverage of Tuesday's address and other stuff since that I would score highly. First, there was Daniel Dale. Now, Daniel Dale is the Washington bureau chief of the Toronto Star. At the top of Thursday's Toronto Star, he has gotten the top billing under a headline, "Trump's Immigration Stance Raises Alarm." Now, why is this special? It is special because Daniel Dale, right off the top of his piece, brings in historical parallels to Hitler. It starts off, Claudia Kounz, K-O-O-N-Z, a historian at Duke University, wrote a book about how the Nazis prepared Germans to accept genocide. One of their tactics was portraying average Jews, who were overwhelmingly law-abiding, as a menace to society. In the 1930s, for example, a Nazi newspaper published a weekly list of the alleged crimes of Jews. So what did Trump do? In January, Trump ordered his government to publish a weekly list of crimes committed by illegal immigrants who are overwhelmingly law-abiding in most of the country's big cities. So the thing is that it was only in the Toronto Star that I saw coverage of that speech and that particular part of the speech, which was not what we would call ahistorical. In other words, it drew a historical parallel. Mm. Well, more could be said about that, but the second specific point I'd like to bring up is Leah McLaren's column in the Globe and Mail this morning. Now, she quotes extensively from a think piece published by The Guardian in the UK, and oddly, she doesn't use the name of the author, who is Carol Cadwallader. She's Welsh. She's a former Daily Telegraph journalist. She now contributes features and columns to The Observer, and then The Guardian picked her up. Now, in this piece that Leah McLaren is simply quoting. It's not investigative journalism in one sense, because McLaren is just quoting the Guardian piece that Cadwallader did. But Cadwallader did the investigative journalism. And what she looks into is the connections between Trump and his single largest donor, who contributed $13.5 million to Trump's campaign. And that is a guy named Robert Mercer, a hedge fund billionaire. And Mercer specializes in computer analytics. And he's very interested in mass propaganda via social media algorithms. And there's a lot of really valuable stuff in this relatively long column by Leah McLaren. But I would just mention a couple of quotes that McLaren has chosen from Cadwallader's piece toward the end. And she quotes Professor Jonathan Rust, director of Cambridge University's Center for Psychometrics, and he spoke to The Guardian. And he said, what Mercer is doing, and obviously Trump has bought into it and is deeply involved in it, along with Steve Bannon, he said, it's nothing short of mass brainwashing. This is a direct quote, and it's happening. The danger of not having regulation around the sort of data you can get from Facebook and elsewhere is clear. With this, a computer can actually do psychology. It can predict and potentially control human behavior. It's not an exaggeration to say that minds can be changed. Behavior can be predicted and controlled. People don't know it's happening to them. Their attitudes are being changed behind their backs. Now, this is the kind of information that, in my opinion, the media should be dealing in much, much more than they do. And I have long been a person who said that we have to pay attention to neurobiology and neuropsychology and neurophysiology. And indeed, I practically shouted yay out loud when I read Leah McLaren's second paragraph. She said, this idea that human biases in perception can create an illogical and highly subjective state of, quote, reality, unquote, has been well explored in the fields of neuroscience, psychology, and behavioral economics. And then she quotes a book title. So anyway, you have to find some rays of light, shall we say, in the mainstream media coverage. But they're too few and far between. That would be my conclusion.
Okay. Well, Barry, I really want to thank you for giving us that assessment, and look forward to having you on again.
Thanks so much, Michael.
So we've been speaking with Barry Zwicker. He is a retired journalist and also a prominent media critic. You can catch more of his articles if you go to the website truthandshadows.wordpress.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.